Here's the extremely uncute voice of Criswell. Cute anyway. Take it away, Jaron King Criswell. Preacher One.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
Okay, it's Radio Mysterioso here for Sunday, the 28th of August, 2011. Can I hear myself? Oh, there we go, volume. And tonight, as promised a couple of weeks ago and last week, we have Nick Redfern on with us. The book that is not new. We seem to come on the scene a little bit late to interview him about his books, but this has been postponed probably mostly and completely through my fault. The book's called The Real Men in Black. Came out, a few months ago, I think. And if you've listened to this show before, you don't need any introduction to Nick Redfern. I believe his last book was Contactees. Let me hook Nick in here. He's got on the Skype. I got to get a little switcher thing in here. Nick, are you there?
Hey, Greg. Yeah, I am. How's it going?
It's working this time.
Good.
Contactees, Three Men Seeking Monsters, Final Events, Anyway, hundreds of books. I told Sigrid, my wife, that I'd be interviewing you again today, and she said, why did he wake up and was there a book underneath his pillow that he'd written? Nick has got so many ideas for books, but the thing is, unlike most people that just say, yeah, it'd be a good book, he actually goes and writes it.
I think it's one of these things where, you know, I have a lot of different things that interests me, you know, and I think when somebody just kind of focuses on, say, one thing, UFOs, that's fine, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're really just looking to focus on the UFO subject, then, you know, it's a case of which good cases haven't been done. You know, that's why, one of the reasons why I like to jump around is because I have a lot of different interests. You know, I have kind of a low boredom threshold. I don't want to just, I'm not the sort of person who wants to write, you know, a book on the Kingman crash, then the Aztec crash, then the Roswell crash.
Yeah.
You know, that would drive me insane. But if I want to do, you know, one book, say, on Bigfoot, then a UFO book, then, you know, on something else, it's actually not that difficult, you know, because it's totally different topics. You know, you're not kind of just having to sort of think, oh, I've done a UFO book, now I've got to do another and another and another, you know.
Right, right.
So, yeah, well, you know, well, yeah, that's well, what I do. You know, that's my job as well. You know, I mean, I do 8 hours a day. I just write 8 hours a day, pretty much. And
yeah, that's the other thing with Nick. He treats the writing as a job, eight-hour day job, and you can't help but produce when that's your goal. I'm still trying to get the next one started here, and then. Did I tell you?
Yeah,
I
wouldn't want people to think it's not a passion as well. You know, I mean, there's.
Well, of course it is. Why else would you do it?
You know, we've all worked jobs that are just a job. If you can turn your passion into a job, then I think you perform better at it, hopefully. And so that's why, you know, with me, yes, it is a job, but it isn't a cynical, oh, God, it's just that thing I've got to do again. You know, it's also a passion, and if I didn't want to do it, you know, I'd, you know, immediately find another job, you know. So as long as that passion's there, you know, I'm happy for it to be, to treat it, you know, sort of a job hours, you know, this is, it's, you know, it's what I like, it's what fascinates me. But, you know, you have to deal with publishers and, you know, contracts and treat it like that, you know, and not get ripped off or whatever.
Yeah, which happens to a lot of people, although some things are changing, and I guess the self-publishing thing is...
Yeah.
Is has taken off in the last few years, but you can make it work with a publisher. I mean, that's almost rare now.
Well, it is, and I think it's getting rarer. But I think that the problem, you know, I'm not trying to make me sound any different word, but I think a lot of authors, they don't like the idea of self-publishing because a lot of them have a high degree of like self-importance. No, I'm an author, and I want to be with a publisher, do you know what I mean? Well, it's like, you know, yeah. Too bad, you know, things are changing. So, you know, the way I look at it is if you self-published a book and sell 50,000 copies and kept a publisher out the loop, well, that's great, you know what I mean? But it's then you're always going to have somebody who's going to say, oh, well, Greg's self-published, you know, he's not with some company in, you know, in New York or whatever, do you know what I mean? And to me, that's just bullshit. I don't get that. It's like, you know, the thing is to get the information out, hopefully write it in a informative and entertaining way, you know, and do what you've got to do. And, you know, if you're able to earn a living from it in that fashion, which is different to, say, the publishing world was 10 years ago, well, you know, to me, that's great. You know, it allows more people to advance in the subject. So.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like the internet. It also allows for a lot of junk. But however, the people complain about that. I think usually they just don't want to. They want to have things handed to them instead of go out and look. And
there's good things and bad things about self-publishing, but I think the concept overall actually sort of wins hands down when you're versus, you know, going against a regular publisher. I mean, I'm sure you know one of the things with regular publishers, they usually put like a set word count on what, you know, do not exceed this amount.
Yeah.
Well, if you've got a really great story, you've got to, I won't say dumb it down, but you've got to trim it just to 65,000 words. Well, you know, that's not always the greatest thing just to get a book deal, you know, when you then have these stipulations and things like that put into it. So.
Yeah, well, sometimes I think, we'll get to Men in Black here in a second, but sometimes I think that sometimes they're artificial because they think that's what people want. And in another way, I think a lot of publishers, they see which books sell and they see which books don't. And the books that tend to sell are the ones that tell a good story and that get to the point and are probably over within, you know, two or 300 pages for a nonfiction book. And that's why I think they put those stipulations on there. Partly. That's one of the downsides, I guess, of self-publishing is you have no editor and people can go on forever, which means that, you know, probably 75% to 90% of the self-published books are boring. But that's the same with most books. Mm-hmm. But there's a value in having an editor, actually. And if you can get one, I think you're lucky because there's no way you can come out with something perfect out the gate, even though you think it is. At least that's what I think.
I agree. I mean, you know, we both work with some good editors. I mean, you know, I think Patrick Wege at Anomalous Books is one of the best editors that I've ever had, probably the best, but it's for several reasons. One, not just the fact that he's a good editor, but Patrick's very good. When you've got a really complex story and you may be thinking, you know, which way should I tell it? You know, historically, where do I begin? You know, what's the middle section, etc. Patrick's good at sort of, you know, juggling around chapters and saying, you know, put this here, put that there, let's tell this bit first or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's important, you know, in any story, whether it's UFOs or you're writing a history of whatever, you know, it doesn't matter what the subject is. And I think, you know, a good editor is excellent at doing that. But, you know, I still think there are, certainly the way publishing's going right now, I think kind of the do-it-yourself thing, you know, even though it takes it away from, you know, the sort of the mainstream publishing world, I think the upside is that in many respects, it takes us back to an era that a lot of people thought was gone. It was sort of like the zine era, you know, the do-it-yourself magazines.
Yeah.
They kind of went out the window, and it's all blogs now.
Yeah.
Well, but it's almost, you could argue, it's changing back, where everybody's getting on the self-publishing book wagon, you know, and it's like people are going back to that thing, you know what I mean? And, okay, it might be downloaded in an electronic format, but it's still... You know, the individual is, you know, putting out his or her stuff that they're enthusiastic about and bypassing, you know, going through like a regular newspaper or whatever. It's like the equivalent of the zine, I think, coming back a little bit.
Well, Nick, you know me. As soon as you say that you think that self-publishing is wonderful, I'll point out the problems with it. And as soon as somebody comes on and says, well, people should be publishing books through publishers, and I'm immediately going to take your point of view and say, and that's the one I agree with, actually, that I think it's great. Anything that spreads more information to more people with less restrictions has got to be good, even though you don't get the filtering. I don't care. I mean, the downside is the filtering isn't as good, but the upside is also the filtering is not as good.
Well,
you know?
there is that, but I mean, I think, you know, discerning readers, you know, the word soon gets around if this book's bullshit or crap or whatever.
Yeah,
you know, or it just hasn't the editing's awful. It wasn't spell checked or whatever.
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, one of the things we're up against is the writing can be, I mean, put it bluntly, I don't want to make enemies, you know, I'm not saying it to make enemies, you know, if I do, that's how it goes. But book writing can be kind of a pompous field, you know, there are people in it,
sure.
I'm a published author, you know, as they say it as they're smoking a cigarette with a little holder on the end, you know what I mean?
Yes.
That kind of thing. And I think there are certain authors who feel threatened by the idea of self-publishing because it does take away from, in their eyes, that idea of, well, I'm with this publishing house, you're just self-publishing. Well, it's like, well, so what? You know what I mean?
Well, that,
that's my view on it anyway.
Yeah. Mine too. I mean, that used to be more of a point, I think, but not so much now. If your book is selling, then, you know, and how many times have these authors with their cigarette holder and all that, how long did they work at it before, you know, somebody finally noticed?
They could have
written a good book 15 years ago, but only 10 years ago anybody noticed because they couldn't get the damn thing out there.
Mm-hmm. And that's the challenge, is not writing a great book. The challenge often is getting a publisher to publish it and recognizing it for what it is. And sometimes they recognize it for what it is. It's like if the market's down on this subject or that subject, you know, it's kind of like, will they touch it, you know? So.
Yeah, and often they won't. I've done that many times where I've suggested titles, and then they say, no, I don't think so. And then a couple years later, that sort of title comes out, either from the same publisher or a similar one or something like that. And everybody I've talked to, including published authors, I mean, look at Richard Dolan. I mean, he's not somebody that's a national figure that everybody knows if they turn on the news. However, and he's not making I don't think he's making an incredibly great living off of his work, but all of his stuff, I think, with the exception of the first book, has been self-published. The last, the National Security State 2, and is 3 out?
I'm not sure if it's out. I mean, I truthfully can't remember if it's out or not. But
okay.
I mean,
but he's got enough of a name that he can push it, and people know what they're going to get from him, and he doesn't have to deal with it. An editor, a publisher, anything like that. And yes, it's a little bit more work, but you're reaping a lot more of the benefits from it.
Yeah, and you're actually reading, you know, everything that Richard wants in there.
Yeah.
You know, that's the important thing. I mean, you know, I think one of the good things about Richard's books, you know, is they're lengthy. Sometimes the downside is, as I said, with a major publisher, they're like, they balk at the idea of a 500-page book.
Yeah,
because they think people aren't going to spend $25, whereas they might spend $13 on a 200-page book or whatever. So.
Yeah, but for the self-published author, who cares? You can sell.
Yeah.
That's something that actually Walter pointed out to me. He goes, if you're going to self-publish a book, sell it for like a dollar or two. And I kind of like balked at it. And he goes, how many people you think are going to buy a $2 book as opposed to a $20 or $15 or $20 book? Mm-hmm. He said that's something to consider. So, yeah, you know, that's another thing. Either that or, you know, bring it out with some certain price and then wait like a year just so everybody won't get mad and then lower the price just like you would on any other product.
Yeah.
But to the subject, Nick did not self-publish this book, The Men in Black, The Real Men in Black. It's from New Page, who published your last one, Contactees, right?
Yeah, I've done five with New Page. Contactees, Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, NASA Conspiracies, this one. And then I've got a couple more coming out with them as well. So.
Oh, excellent. Are you working on both of them, or one is near completion? Or?
Yeah, well, one actually is completed. It comes out in December. It's called Keep Out, and it's a study of like secret installations with links to UFOs. So there's like a chapter on Area 51, a chapter on the Hangar 18 rumors, a chapter on the Russian Area 51, stuff like that. So it's not like a study of secret military installations, you know, like a conspiracy type book. It's where they've all got like a link with UFOs or 4T and stuff. So.
Right. Have you heard? Did you ever see that book Scare Force? It's one of my favorite titles.
Oh yeah, I know.
Yeah, I love that book. If only for the title. And did you run into, this is off the subject too now, 15 minutes into the show, did you ever run into the stories of Bigfoot being sighted at Edwards Air Force Base in the underground facilities?
I don't know that story, but I have actually heard a few stories of, well, actually more than a few, of Bigfoot sort of seen on the fringes of military installations. There's actually, within cryptozoology, there's actually quite a few that fall into that category. I haven't heard that one about underground, though, Edwards, no.
Yeah, completely unconfirmed, but I was saying, well, there's never been Bigfoot sighted in the desert, so what does that mean? And then I started looking it up, and I find in some of my books and all over the internet that, indeed, there are Bigfoot sightings in the desert, and there have been. And one of the ones was a guy that was head of the Southern California Bigfoot Research or something like that for a long time. Said that he had talked to more than one person, according to him, that had said there were Bigfoot-type entities walking around in the facilities at Edwards, specifically some underground ones, and that they had been caught on camera and people had encountered them in these underground areas, and that they were told to basically just leave them alone because there's really nothing they could do about it, apparently. And the things weren't doing anything. They were just walking around and confusing and freaking people out. So I don't know how much truth there is to that, but it would seem to make sense in light of a lot of the other paranormal things that seem to cluster.
That's kind of makes sense in one sense. It's almost believable in the sense like the government say, oh, you know, ignore them, leave them alone. You know, you imagine the government's going to round them up and experiment on them. You know,
what do you think they're going to do? You know, what can they do?
Leave them alone, you know, stay away from them. It almost sounds more believable in that respect.
Yeah, actually. You know, or that's just what they want you to think. I don't know. But in line with Bigfoots and UFOs and the paranormal, we should talk about Men in Black, because that's what we said we're going to talk about on this show. It's called, actually, the book is called The Real Men in Black, which I think actually applies pretty well to the book. And you go through the entire history, the Men in Black, recounting stories, as you should, probably a few of which I'd never heard and kind of fascinated me, and then details like things about Albert Bender, which I hadn't heard, which we will get into. And then Nick quite logically goes into what are the theories and what might be likely. I think I was going to say, why don't we introduce what the subject is and what people, it's like people listening to this show know that. And so I don't really think we need to say what Men in Black are, things that show up after people have UFO, you know.
Yeah,
however, however, if you are interested in the subject, you might not know the details of how Albert Bender, basically in his book Flying Saucers and the Three Men, and with Gray Barker and through his experiences, basically created that mythos and may have done it based on more fantasy than actual people coming in bothering him, as far as I could tell from your text. Is that true?
Well, yeah, I mean, to an extent it is, but when we say fantasy, I'm not entirely sure. That kind of makes it sound like sort of deliberate and cynical. I'm not sure it was.
I don't mean fantasy, but it's more like a co-creation of his mind and the phenomena and what his set and setting was than literal men in black arriving at the door and telling them to cut it out and then disappearing around the corner. It wasn't like that for Albert Bender.
No, it wasn't. I mean, it's not like this is our or my assumption. I mean, this is actually what Bender says. The ironic thing is that many people within ufology assume that, you know, the phenomenon, although there's some weird aspects to it, you know, it always kind of involves guys turning up on the door, knocking, you know, on the front door, coming in, and then making this veiled threat and then leaving. Albert Bender, who ironically was probably the one person more than any other who really sort of kicked off the Men in Black mystery in the early 50s, you know, there were a few, like a handful of sort of quasi-MIB stories in the post-Kenneth Arnold era in June 47. And there was, you know, the Maury Island story that was sort of linked with a dark-suited character and surveillance of some of the people and what sounded like motel room bugging and things like that. You know, but that sounds more like military intel or something. You know, Bender's story is very different. I mean, I won't sort of go into all the full intricacies of it, but I mean, Bender was someone who, he was a very intriguing and complex character. He was, when his UFO research really kicked off, this was sort of the post-war era, and he got involved and interested in, you know, the UFO subject, and he actually took a deep interest in the disappearance of Flight 19, you know, the Navy guys who vanished.
The Bermuda Triangle story.
Or got, you know, lost or whatever, however you want to term it, you know, and sort of helped give birth to the Bermuda Triangle mystery. But he was very interested in that story. Now, when UFOs kicked off in 47, he sort of gravitated to that. But he was someone who was also already deeply interested in paranormal phenomena. He actually had a relative who, of all things, was visited by a woman in black in the middle of the night. It kind of sounds like almost like an old hag type story, you know, like incubus, succubus type thing. There was a story about the family and like a ghostly phenomenon at a cemetery and all sorts of weird stuff. And he was also heavily into Ouija boards, but also like occult literature, you know, Edgar Allan Poe, H.P. Lovecraft, people like that. So in other words, he was someone, I guess, primed to gravitate towards UFOs when that kicked off as well. And he was living at the time in Bridgeport, Connecticut. He actually lived in an attic of his stepfather's house, which he converted into what he called his Chamber of Horrors. And it had like plastic spiders hanging from the ceiling and skulls and all sorts of stuff. He painted the walls with like monstrous faces and things like this. Spent most of his free time in the attic, particularly when he set up the International Flying Saucer Bureau, and basically, you know, it took off. It became huge, and he began, you know, answering mail by the sack load, and, you know, it sort of, for whatever reason, it became sort of a major force at the time within early ufology. And the interesting thing about Bender was that he said that when his UFO research began and sort of really kicked off, his sort of typical Saturday night routine, he comes across a very sort of solitary character in his books and writings and what everybody said about him. Saturday nights, you know, would always be the local cinema. You know, bear in mind this was sort of 51, 52, so one week he'd be going seeing Invasion of the Body Snatchers, then Day of the Earth Stood Still, then Thing from Another World or whatever.
Yeah.
And he said that even in the cinema and on his way home, he would sort of see these shadowy figures, which... The best way you can describe, they sound like an upgraded vampire motif, you know, but instead of the cloak, you know, they've got the black suit. But they were sort of shadowy, wraith-like. They would hide in the shadows, lurking and menacingly watching him, and these weird, glowing, self-illuminated eyes. And they would sort of literally wink in and out of existence.
Yeah.
He would get home all in a panic. And on some nights, not on every occasion, but some nights, he would then start to feel funny, sort of weird, spaced out, lightheaded, dizzy. And he'd get this overpowering smell of brimstone in the room, or sulfur, and he'd have to lay down, and he'd kind of feel himself sinking or leaving his body, and then suddenly, the men in black would manifest in the room, and it was almost like you know, he had some sort of weird altered state experience rather than a physical knock on the front door. Now, one of the things I point out in the book, that many of the characteristics that Bender reported, the smells, these high, like sulfur-like smells with no discernible cause, the lightheadedness, the spaced-out sense, etc. A lot of these are actually a symptom of one particular type of epilepsy called Jacksonian epilepsy. Now, we can't prove Bender had that, but it does suggest maybe there was some sort of misfiring of his mind going on. Now, the other thing that was going on at the time is that, you know, the CIA with the Robertson panel was recommending that some of the early UFO groups should be watched closely.
Yeah.
Now, we know people like APRO were being watched. We also know the FBI went out and visited people like, for example, Adamski, Van Tassel, because the files have now been declassified through the Freedom of Information Act showing that. And granted, this is speculation, but there were rumors that, you know, Bender got the visit from the government. You know, they wanted to know what he was doing. And he comes across as a very timid, nervous character. You know, he was someone who was deathly afraid of developing cancer, you know, even though he was like late 20s, early 30s at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had no reason for believing that he would develop it, but he had this irrational fear. Now, one of the things I speculate in the book, maybe he really was visited by somebody from the government. You know, back in the 50s, they would have worn the black suit and the fedora-type hat and the black skinny tie, etc. If they were from the FBI, they probably would have been pretty imposing, you know, and it probably scared him if that did happen. And the time frame of what the Robertson panel was doing, that fits in. Now, from there, if that did happen, or even if it didn't happen, but he feared it happening because he may have known other friends and colleagues that it happened to, if that imagery of these dark-suited figures banging on the front door from the government played on his mind so much as his fears of cancer did, if he entered some sort of altered state of mind, those sort of subconscious feelings or thoughts or imagery might have sort of come tumbling out of his subconscious, and then he figured that it was real, you know. But then what if the phenomenon itself, the undoubtedly real UFO phenomenon, got its grips into him and kind of modeled, if you like, the way it manifested for Bender in the form of, you know, the proto-men in black, you know, in the same way that you could argue that in times past the phenomenon appeared as goblins or fairies or demons. You know, maybe the manifestation for Bender was the men in black, because he had already got long-standing anxieties about being visited by government people who looked just like that. So ironically, you know, he could have given birth to an aspect of the phenomenon, partly born out of his subconscious and partly born out of how the phenomenon manifested for him by pulling on, you know, his beliefs, etc. If that
right.
makes sense.
Yeah, well, of course it makes sense. But the thing is that if Bender was a nobody, it's funny, the way you describe him, the way I've heard about him, and Mosley has talked to me about him a bit, sounds like somebody who basically didn't have any, there was no goth community, there was no horror community, there was nothing like that. I don't even think there was a fan community at that time, really. I mean, there was a bit. But not really organized the way it is now, so he spun off into his own universe.
Well, that's right, he did. You know, he was very much a loner and did his magazine alone. But the thing was, where he kind of differed from a lot of other people, you know, although there wasn't so much of a community, you know, when word got out about his magazine, just dozens and hundreds of people eventually started subscribing to it. You know, so in that respect, I think if somebody was going to get a visit, it would have been someone like Bender, because, you know, they were watching people who were selling books. The government, I mean, were watching people like Adamski, who was selling thousands of copies of his books. They're watching people like Van Tassel putting on conferences at Giant Rock where there are thousands of people attending.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think in the same fashion, they're going to listen to someone or watch someone who, you know, is selling 150 copies of his magazine, and it's, you know, been picked up in England and Australia and, you know, who knows where else, which is what happens.
Yeah, and the other thing I wanted to mention is, and of course you cover very well in the book, is Gray Barker's participation in all this and how he helped spread, basically, a lot better almost than Bender could, spread his ideas out through the popular culture, and especially the people who are interested in UFOs.
Yeah, I mean, just before I get to Bach, one of the things I would sort of stress to people listening, you know, rather than just go over old ground, I mean, I interviewed something like about 25 people for the book, and a lot of the people who knew people like Bach, I mean, people like Alan Greenfield, Brad Steiger, Jim Moseley, Jerry Clark, you know, all these people who were sort of around in the 60s, etc., and in Jim's case, and you know, certainly from the 50s. So, you know, I wanted to get their perspectives. And, you know, I think there's no doubt that Barker played a tremendous role in sort of nurturing and developing the Men in Black mystery because, you know, Bender himself, you know, he just quit the scene in 53 when he shut down the IFSB. And, you know, a lot of people thought, well, this is just a ploy to get more publicity of his group and he's going to be back next month. You know, kind of like a rock band that just can't stop, you know, they go on endless reunion tours. And but that isn't what happened. You know, he really did quit. And he only very briefly came back in 62 to write Flying Saucers and the Three Men. But, you know, before we get to the 60s, I mean, Barker and Bender were, you know, friends and colleagues. And Jim told me, Jim Moseley, that one of the reasons was because Barker was also interested in horror stuff, you know, in fiction. Yeah. And so it kind of, you know, they had these talking points beyond UFOs as well. And Barker, of course, heard the story of the Men in Black. And Barker being a sort of very, you know, although he's a controversial writer, because as everybody told me, and as most people who've probably read his books will know, you know, he was someone who was a great writer and a great storyteller. And he wasn't a liar, but he would often sort of, you know, gonzo it up a bit. Not to lie, but to try and get an idea or a theme across, if you like, and do it in an entertaining fashion, you know. And he didn't really mind if, as I point out in the book, you know, he changed a bright sunny day to the proverbial dark and stormy night, you know, to if it made the story more adventurous. But then somebody who was involved in the story will say, well, that isn't how it went. But, you know, he wasn't lying. He was literally gonzoing it up to try and get a point across and a message in a fashion that was definitive storytelling, but still based on the facts. And that's why, you know, I think certainly some of the early years of the Men in Black mystery, you know, we have to sort of tread carefully on how we interpret what really happened. But clearly something happened. And, you know, I think Barker was someone who was responsible for the development of the MIB mystery in the 50s and the way it was perceived. The big question is, are our perceptions based on wholly on facts, or is it a bit on, you know, the fact that Barker was a bit of a, he was almost like a Hunter S. Thompson of ufology, if you like. So,
yeah.
In terms of his writing, anyway, you know.
Yeah, but the funny thing is that Moseley said that Barker didn't believe everything he wrote. That was Moseley's take on Barker, that he was very, as far as I can tell,
he
was very interested, but his views changed after a while to the point where he didn't really particularly believe any of it, but he still wanted to sell the books and sort of be part of the publishing.
Yeah, I mean, that's an important point to make, and this is one of the things that Jim pointed out to me, that there's a distinction between the Barker of the 50s and, say, the Barker of the 70s and 80s before his death. Jim said, you know, if you go back and read, like, they knew too much about Flying Saucers, that's definitive Barker telling a story in a fashion that, you know, back then he really did believe something was going on, you know, and he told a story in the way that he thought it would get the message across. You know, I think most people would agree that he got a bit cynical about it by the 70s, so, you know, perhaps by then he really didn't believe, but certainly back then, I think if we go with his 50s work, that is sort of definitive Barker in terms of telling the story how he wanted to tell it, because he really did believe and he really wanted to get something across to people.
Yeah, he, through his book, I mean, he published Flying Saucers and the Three Men, and he also published later, which I'm sure some people know about and was referenced in your book, in the late 70s, I think, a book called Men in Black, The Secret Terror Among Us, which I think, didn't I loan you my copy of that? That spiral-bound one?
You showed it to the original one you had when I was over there in December.
Okay.
But, No, I mean, I've actually got that because it was actually republished about 2 months before my book came out. I wrote the introduction for the new copy.
Tim Beckley.
They actually sent me a copy of it, the original
one. Okay,
okay. So maybe the Men in Black have got yours.
Maybe, but the funny thing was he wrote that book, and it sounds in contrast to Flying Saucers and the Three Men, which Barker probably wrote most of, actually.
Mm-hmm.
This one sounds more like, and he really sets it up as kind of a scare you Halloween story rather than mm-hmm. kind of a factual. He'll take these stories, like the one with the coin disappearing in the guy's hand, which we can talk about, and then he spins them into something that where. You know, if you're reading this book, they're probably watching you, so you should look out for them. And you shouldn't read chapters 6 and 8 if you really are easily scared. And, you know, it was an incredibly melodramatic book.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's the sort of typical type of writing that Barker did. You know, I think at some point we all kind of, you know, have a little bit do that, you know, whether it's, you know, in an article, you want to try, you know, to see what it's like, you know, to sort of write the... It was a dark and stormy night type book, you know what I mean? Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. And I think, but I would say sort of Barker, Keel, you know, they were probably the two best proponents of that sort of, you know, writing. And certainly, I mean, a lot of people may disagree with me, but I actually think Barker's Silver Bridge book on the Mothman mystery is actually better than Keel's Mothman Prophecies.
Yeah, well, I agree with you.
I think he really captures the air of kind of menace that, you know, goes along with the Mothman story, you know. And Keel's is a great book, don't get me wrong. It's one of the ultimate classics.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if you ask me to, you know, put the two against each other, you know, it's kind of like asking me, you know, what's better, the, you know, first Sex Pistols album or first Clash album. You know, that's how I sort of view Barker's book and Keel's book, but I think Barker's is slightly ahead. I really do.
I would tend to agree with you. The first time I read it was probably like about 4 or 5 years ago when it was republished by who republished that? I can't remember who.
Was it Andy Colvin?
Maybe Andy. Well, Andy had a hand in getting it republished, but I don't know if he self-published it. It was a small publisher, I think, that did it. Anyway, incredibly a great book, and if you can, you can still order that. It's not really out of print or anything. Okay. I think it's print on demand probably at this point, so of course it isn't out of print. But yeah, but like you said, Nick, I mean, it's a little more personal than if you can say that, because Keel's book is very personal, but Barker's book is even more personal than that because he actually lived close to what was going on.
Yeah.
And he talked to some of the same people, but a lot of different people, because I think some of the people around Point Pleasant, and this, you know, we can go into the Mothman aspect of the Men in Black here, but I think a lot of the people around Point Pleasant realized that he was basically a local person. So they would be a lot more apt to talk to him than a writer from New York.
I think you're right.
And because of that, there's a much different sense of what the people there thought, how they felt, where they lived, how they lived. I mean, he said he went to a like some house with a dirt floor with like these people with 5 kids and talked to them about their experiences. And I don't think Keel ever went to visit people like that because he didn't know they were there and probably just didn't think they were really part of the story. But they were very much so.
Well, I think what Keel did, Keel certainly spoke to a lot of people. I'm not sure that Keel captured the kind of atmosphere. I don't think he captured the kind of the life, etc., and the imagery as graphically and as, you know, as clearly as Barker did. And I think, you know, you quite right, the fact that he lived in that area, you know, it's kind of like me writing a book about LA. You know, versus you writing it where, you know, I'm not originally from America and I only visit LA now and again. You know, you would clearly see the differences or from, you know, living there.
Yeah.
Versus somebody else who wrote a book who was from there or is from there. You know what I mean? They could describe the smells of the food cooking in the local, you know, where the place we always go. I forget what it's called now. I mean, the big open area. You know what I mean?
And, Farmer's Market.
Farmer's Market. All the subtle things that really... people think, oh, hang on, you know, this guy knows his stuff. Do you know what I mean? And I think that shines through more in Barker's writing. And I think that, granted, the two books are very good because they're both different. You know, it's like...
I'm not denigrating John Keel at all. His book was more personal in what happened to him, I think, because he came into the community and then he became inadvertently... whether you believe all of his stories or not in there, he inadvertently became part of the story himself. I mean, the archetypical reporter becomes part of the story, but it incredibly strange, bizarre twist.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, you've got the whole Men in Black thing, and I think that obviously attracted Barker because, you know, 10 years before, he was, you know, he was the first guy to write about the Men in Black. So I think, you know, forget just Mothman. I think probably... the fact that the MIB was sort of seen there is a prime reason why also he got involved in the story, I think. So. Because he knew it was a captivating subject that would make a page turner. So.
How many Men in Black things were there? The only one I remember from your book and basically from history is the Point Pleasant newspaper reporter, Mary Heyer, those guys that came in her office. And she said, if somebody told me not to do the story, I'd tell them to go to hell, and they disappeared.
Well, yeah, there's actually a few stories from Mary Heyer, you know.
She just died, I think, last year.
Yeah, so it wasn't very long ago at all.
Yeah.
But, I mean, she told a number of stories about sort of weird little guys coming into the offices with strange bowl haircuts and, you know, strange clothing and acting weird and asking questions about UFOs and kind of stumbling when they're talking. And, you know, they come across like definitive Men in Black. Now, there are a few other ones. In Keel's book, certainly not sort of as high profile, you know, where people had said they'd seen someone kind of watching them on the street and things like that. But then again, you know, you have this whole other issue, which is sort of definitively related to the MIB mystery, like telephone interference and weird voices on the phone and, you know, electronic noises. Now, again, it's complicated by the fact that I point out, you know, Barker was also a definitive prankster. And there's a possibility, as Jim told me and a couple of other people told me, you know, yes, something weird was going on, but Barker may well have amplified this and played a few practical jokes of his own, you know. So I think this is all, you know, sort of developed and, you know, nurtured the whole folklore of the MIB to where, you know, you have to be really careful as to how, you know, we differentiate between true MIB phenomena and sort of, you know, somebody having a bit of a trickster-type approach to it and amping up the atmosphere, if you like, for their own reasons. One of which was actually to get the story out, but to do so, you know, they felt the need to kind of exaggerate it a little bit as well.
Yeah, if you look at the mythos that was growing up around the Men in Black, you could... wonder why they keep showing up. I mean, I guess we could say, you know, do this at the end, but when you talk about the Men in Black and, for instance, in Point Pleasant and visiting Mary Heyer, that takes it out of the realm of, this is a newspaper report. It's not somebody publishing with a spook room in their house, self-publishing a flying saucer newsletter, etc. Not to denigrate Albert Bender at all, but, you know, as far as most people are concerned, somebody who's a reporter for a newspaper, their opinion and their stories might hold a little more weight.
I think that's typical of 40-odder in general. You know, it's like we're always fighting that uphill battle.
Yeah, but my point is, they really hadn't bothered too many. Well, I guess there were more stories around in the 1950s that not too many people knew about. But coming from this woman, this strange story of these people coming up, you start to wonder, and people reading the book might start to wonder before they get to the theory section, who are these people? I mean, are they? And maybe your opinion would hold a little of weight. What you might think? Are they specifically maybe Mary Heyer's experience? You know, were they people from the authorities somewhere? Or are they from the chemical plant that Andy Colvin talks about? Or were they true paranormal entities? Or where do you think they land in that spectrum?
Well, I think, you know, this kind of gets to the crux of the whole thing because, you know, when we say who are the Men in Black, are they this, are they that, are they whatever, I think the thing to remember is that for many people, and they don't do it deliberately, it's more unconsciously and subconsciously, they assume that the men in black are this or that. You know, are they government agents, or are they aliens, or are they this?
Right.
You know, I think one of the things that sort of really stood out for me in doing the research was that, you know, I think there could well be several categories of men in black. I think, you know, purely down to the fashions of the era, you know, back in the 50s, FBI guys wore black suits, skinny ties, and fedoras. You know, and if that two of them turn up on your doorstep, they're men in, by definition, they're men in black.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a paranormal aspect, however we define the paranormal. And I think also, I think, and this gets into more sort of like psychological warfare operations, I wouldn't be surprised, and I think there's some evidence for this, that the military or the intelligence world at times has realized that there's capital to be gained in terms of covering their tracks by actually mimicking the weirder men in black. You know, it's kind of like, you know, the guys sitting in the Pentagon saying, hey, you know, this guy's got too close to something. We need to silence him. And to do so, they don't go out in the military uniform with an ID card. They literally, you know, it's like, you know, like a pantomime. They dress up weirdly and act weirdly when they get there to put the fear of God in the person to think they've really been visited by the weirder men in black. And so I think, you know, this is what makes it so difficult to ascertain, you know, which men in black we're talking about, you know, in terms of which case. You know, is it the government mimicking something? Is it the real weird phenomena? Is it just the military guys or the FBI guys at the time wearing this particular fashion? Or is it a combination of all these things, you know? And I think the important thing is not, it's kind of like when people say, are UFOs nonsense or are they alien? You know, it's far more complex in terms of the theories and the ideas. And I think that applies to the men in black. It's not a case, are they government agents or are they aliens? It's far more sort of subtle and in-depth and complex than that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But the basic, I don't know.
Yeah, the answer would be, yeah. The answer to that would be yes to that
yeah.
question. But specifically, I was asking, what do you think happens when somebody like a news reporter... Well, I guess you wouldn't know. I mean, you did answer the question. Who knows what she saw? She saw something, but
she
who knows...
She saw a couple of weird guys who came in and kind of subtly issued threats, et cetera.
Yeah. And then disappeared very quickly. Yes.
Yeah. They're weird guys. They act in strange ways. They fumble. They stutter. They run out of energy. You know, they're not conversant with our mannerisms. But they're clearly trying to intimidate people, and then they just vanish as mysteriously as they arrive. Now, the big question is, of course, is that theater, and they're from the Pentagon, or are they truly strange, or is it both, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, you and I would probably say it might be both. It is truly strange and theater at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, people say, the important thing is people point out the men in black. The whole purpose is, supposedly at least, to silence people. But acting in such a strange fashion, looking so weird, looking so out of time, like they stepped out of some 1950s gangster movie or whatever, actually draws more attention to them. So I think it's kind of like a fine line. There's intimidation involved, but they're trying to spread the motif of the sinister men in black, maybe to, you know, to perpetuate that sinister imagery, you know, that they want people to know about them, to sort of kind of have people in that sort of state of anxiety or something that they might get the visit. You know, if nobody knows about the men in black, no one's going to care.
Yeah.
They'll be worried.
Well, I guess anybody coming up acting very strangely and making definite or veiled or definite threats is going to be noticed. And I forgot the question I was going to ask. Oh, now I remember. In your research doing this book, have you ever found, and I guess Mary Heyer would be one example, but ever found besides her somebody who just said, you guys are full of crap, leave me alone, and just never been bothered? Have they ever followed through on their threats?
Mm. Now, that's actually a very good question, because there are a few cases where, you know, for the most part, one of the weird things about men in black encounters is that one of the reasons why they're so able to intimidate the witnesses is, you know, they turn up, say, 11 o'clock at night, bang on the door, and the person goes to the door. You know, most people, your first thought is somebody knocks on the door at 11 at night, it's the cops with bad news or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So they kind of tentatively look through the spy hole or open the door with the chain on.
Uh-huh.
And the weird thing is the men in black, you know, if you open the door and the street guy's there at midnight, fedoras, black suits and sunglasses, you don't let them in. But people do let them in. You know, it's almost like their common sense factor and logic goes out the window or is controlled or manipulated in some fashion to where they let them in. They just sit back and listen to the intimidation, you know, and then the MIB leave. And then the kind of the common sense part of the mind comes back into play again. You know, they think, why the hell did I do that? But the point I'm sort of reaching is that there are occasions where people's minds haven't kind of been rewired and they've said, no, get out, you know, just leave, just get out the house right now. Now, in most of the there aren't many cases where that's happened, but in most of the ones that we have on record where it has happened, it's almost like they don't know what, the MIB don't know what to do. It's like they've been almost like they've been pre-programmed to, this is what you'll say, this is what you'll do, and this is what you'll, you know, how you'll intimidate the witness. And when somebody doesn't go along with it and they say, no, the hell with you, get out, it's almost like there's nothing in the MIB's
mindset. This isn't going to script. Yeah.
Yeah, it is almost like a script, like a computer program. And, you know, it's kind of like you've got too many programs running at some point on your computer and you crash your computer or whatever. It's kind of like that. It's like the mainframe of the MIB is crashed when something happens out of the ordinary.
Yeah, be they government people or actual strange entities or UFO beings or whatever, just doesn't seem like they can deal with ambiguity or, like you said, something that doesn't go along with a script. So nobody has ever really been, they've been threatened heavily, but never, nothing's ever happened. They're empty threats.
Well, I mean, you can look at it, you can actually look at it, I guess, in different ways. I mean, one of the ways, you know, is that it's always with hindsight that people say, oh, well, they were threatened, you know, and they say, well, where's the evidence? I mean, you can go back to like the 50s when people like Morris Jessop started to get in, you know, he wrote a casebook for the UFO.
Yeah.
He was involved in the Philadelphia experiment with Carlos Allende and all sorts of people. You know, he was checking into South American ruins and ancient aliens, all sorts of stuff. You know, and he felt he was being watched and he got paranoid and all sorts of strange things began to happen to him. And then one day he was found dead in his car, you know, with like a pipe in the exhaust and just, you know, he died. But then, you know, with hindsight, people could say, well, you know, the man in black got to him because he said he was being watched. So, you know, it's always kind of a gray area because ufologists are people at the end of the day. People die of old age for the most part, but some commit suicide, you know. Somebody gets hit by a car or a bus or whatever. And if they've talked about being watched at some previous point, inevitably, ufology being ufology, questions are going to come up about, was it just an accident? Well, for the most part, it is just an accident because, you know, there's nothing special about ufologists. We're just normal people. You know, so it is difficult to try and ascribe whether a threat's been followed through or 5 years after somebody got a really bad MIB visit, they died prematurely or whatever. You know, it's difficult to say.
Yeah, well, it's also often after they've completely stopped whatever they were doing anyway.
Yeah, so yeah, that's right. I mean, that is one of the important things. I mean, you know, it's like, for example, Albert Bender. You know, I mean, you know, 20 years after, do I think he had anything to worry about? Well, no. You know, so, I mean, you could argue that it worked on him and there was never any need for a return visit, which would arguably just add to the controversy, you know. That is one of the weird things about the Men in Black is that, you know, it's not like they're always turning up on people's doorsteps, you know, every other week. It's almost like when you had the visit, you know, it's like having chicken pox. Once you've got it, once you've had it, it's gone. You know what I mean? It's kind of, they don't come back.
You're inoculated.
You know? But yeah, that's right. Yeah.
No, there aren't any repeaters for Men in Black, really.
Well, for the most part, there aren't. There are one or two cases, but, I mean, they're few and far between. You know, it really is, they're there, and then it sort of see you. And, well, no, they don't see you again. So.
Yeah. I when I was interviewing Dean Radin in the 90s, we were talking about, and I guess he had talked to a few people, so he couldn't, and he knew some things, but he couldn't tell me exactly. He said, I've looked at the magazine, and I see what you write about, and he says, and given what you write about, it would be surprising to me if you hadn't had a Men in Black type experience. And I said, well, I haven't really. And he said, well, then you will. Which was really strange to me. Which also brings to mind that... Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think a lot of people in ufology, you know, have had weird experiences. You know, everybody, I think, you know, kind of wonders occasionally, you know, what was that weird noise on the phone? You know, what was that weird voice on the phone? Why was the mail late, you know, for 3 days or something? And I think... You know, for the most part, do I think it's just down to logistics and the occasional glitch on the phone? Yeah, I think it probably is. But I think occasionally, you know, there's this tendency where people associate, if you're in ufology, they associate everyday things that are just a normal aspect of Monday morning pain in the neck type stuff as being the manipulative hand of some higher force. And now maybe, I'm not trying to be cynical, maybe sometimes it is, but I think sometimes in ufology what happens is that kind of worry gets amped up to a bigger level than it does outside of ufology, you know, because people within ufology think they've got something to worry about, when maybe they do, you know. So again, it's like a fine line between, okay, the mail's late for 3 days, but then when, you know, if the mail's late once a week and people start really getting the mode of, like, you know, putting a camera on the roof of the house shining down on the mailbox, that's when you've kind of lost the plot. And I think, you know, in that respect, that's the fine line being crossed, you know, in terms of how we sort of really differentiate between, you know, being watched by the LIB and, you know, like Dean's saying, well, you will get the visit. You know, you then start looking for things that might be evidence, not necessarily deliberately, but you start looking for stuff that might be evidence of the visit. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I can't remember where the paranoia period came before or after that. I think it was after that. But I would actually go further with it and say that a lot of people involved in UFO study would like to think what they're doing is important, so they keep a lookout for that stuff, which actually makes them no different than most people. I mean, most people want to think that what they do has an impact. And, you know, just statistically, in the way things are, most things that most people do not have an impact. So if you've got, you know, that combined with the lore of the Men in Black, makes people kind of hyper vigilant about things, you know. You would think that if nobody says anything or threatens you or anything like that, it must follow that you're not doing anything important, right? That's how a lot of people think.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there is a side to that also, but I also think that probably a lot of people in ufology are watched. I don't mean, you know, Men in Black stuff, but I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if, say, for example, if there is some sort of clandestine group in government, you know, that monitors the UFO subject, they probably do just sort of go down to Barnes and Noble and pick up the latest UFO magazine. Not, you know, they don't need to necessarily keep tabs on everybody, you know, with sophisticated monitoring or whatever. But, you know, if John Smith or Bill Jones or whoever writes an article for UFO magazine, it probably gets read and, you know, somebody notes it or talks about it. So, you know, maybe even someone who's just done a 500-word post or whatever.
Yeah.
Don't necessarily become the subject of a file, but they get discussed. you know, so I that wouldn't surprise me at all. So, but, you know, I think, but that's a big difference to, you know, the MIB turning up and bugging your house and standing outside your door every other week. Now, there are people who've reported that, and I think they're legitimate cases. And I think the key is, the critical issue is to understand what it is about those people or those cases that warrants that. You know, a lot of people think the Men in Black, if you're a UFO researcher and the Men in Black are watching you, you know, that it's often, well, what case are they looking at? You know, which case have they just been investigating that might warrant the MIB turning up or whatever? But maybe, you know, we should be looking at the person. What else are they doing? You know, who else have they been speaking to? You know, look at the bigger picture of things like that as well.
Yeah, what sighting have they been talking about, and where is it located? And you know, they're looking at keywords, I suppose. What if you say Kwajalein Atoll in the Pacific Islands, where a lot of missiles are tested? Now, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, nobody knew about that place.
Yeah.
But if a
yeah.
UFO researcher suddenly starts talking about that on the phone or in his email or whatever, in his or her email, yeah, I suppose that, you know, and it has nothing to do with let's find out what they know about the aliens. It's let's find out what they know about, you know, the missile test or whatever.
Yeah. But, and I think, that, again, this is the big thing that kind of creates a lot of the problems when it comes to resolving the whole Men in Black mystery, because it's become so steeped in the folklore of the Men in Black.
Yeah.
That reality, you know, it becomes harder and harder to understand because, purely and simply because it is so saturated, you know, with the pop culture aspect of the MIB versus, you know, the actual hard and facts such as they are, at least. So.
Yeah, which actually this paranoia and what you who you think is watching you brings to mind another chapter in the book about photographic evidence Tim Beckley's famous picture of the guy in the doorway, which I think I'd only heard. No, I had heard both sides of the story, both Jim Moseley and Tim Beckley. But
yeah,
and the, you know, the picture's there, and I think it's online. Could you give a short description of that? What you think? What do you think of that episode?
Well, yeah, I mean, this. You know, people ask, you know, what evidence is there for the existence of the Men in Black? Well, you know, there's no doubt we have a lot of highly credible witness testimony. And, you know, I'm absolutely convinced that a lot of people have received some sort of visitation. There's no, I actually do believe that. The problem is that, you know, the MIB are very skillful at kind of covering their tracks and, you know, to the point where they've never really physically caught one. But they have, allegedly at least, been captured on film. I have a chapter on this in the book where I talk about two cases, one from Alan Greenfield in 69 and the more famous one, 68, involving Tim Beckley and Jim Moseley.
Yeah.
And this relates to a husband and wife team, Jack and Mary Robinson, who lived in Jersey City. Jack was a big-time UFO researcher in that period, and Mary was sort of more into paranormal stuff, and she was a housewife. She stayed at home while Jack would go to work. And at one point, interestingly enough, it coincided with them, where it seemed like when they go out for dinner on one particular, or a couple of occasions, they got home, as if somebody had been rifling through Jack's files, you know, this sort of created paranoia, I suppose. And Mary said that one occasion she happened to look out the apartment window, and there was this sort of weird guy stood in the recesses of the doorway opposite the building. And he was, you know, black suit, black fedora, black tie, actually a black trench coat over a black suit, and had this sort of weird look on his face where she couldn't really pinpoint it. It wasn't like, you know, he was grinning weirdly or, you know, screaming at her, but he was almost like zombie expressionless like, but also a menacing expression. It was a menacing expression of expressionless, if you like. And, you know, she was quite disturbed by it. But what was interesting and possibly almost unique was that the guy was there 3 or 4 days running. And when this, you know, happened over the course of several days, because Mary and Jack knew that both Tim and Jim were, you know, had done a lot of MIB investigations, and on top of that, you know, Jim knew Barker, etc. They called him up and basically said, well, you know, do you want to come over? So Tim phoned Jim. They got over to Jersey City early one weekday morning, you know, busy street, so they couldn't stop the car. So Tim kind of leaned out and took a picture, and sure enough, there was this guy, you know, in the black suit, just as Mary described him, like 4 days running, just sort of staring enigmatically at the doorway of this old building. And, you know, the photo exists. There's no doubt that they took a picture of a guy in a black suit, black sunglasses and fedora and trench coat at 8:30 in the morning, the fourth day after he'd been there for 3 previous days. You know, Tim believes it's a genuine man in black. Jim, you know, thought it may have been some sort of, like, you know, like a lookout guy for some operation or, you know, something crime-related or whatever, maybe.
A bookie joint, he said.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, granted, we're not really sure what the truth is as to who, you know, this guy was, but I mean, And again, this is one of the big problems, you know, that we face. Are we dealing with a man in black, or are we dealing with a man who happens to be dressed in a black suit? You know, and of course, when you're in ufology and you see a guy in a black suit and sunglasses right over the road from your house, even the most grounded ufologist is going to wonder, is it the man in black? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can't help it, you know, because we know the myth, we know the folklore. So.
And then there's that picture by Greenfield, which I'd heard of, but I think I might have seen it before, but it's published in the book. The guy actually kind of looks like my friend Walter.
He does look like Walter, actually.
But it's
like
from 1969, when Walter would have been, what, 7 years old? So
he does look like Walter, though. That was,
yeah, quite a bit.
But it's actually a funny point. But, I mean, this is one where, I mean, Alan, you know, told me it was actually the UFO conference in 69, the National UFO Conference Jim used to put on. And he told me how, for example, you know, this guy was hanging around. He had the black suit, the sunglasses, black jacket and trousers. But he had like a turtleneck on. He didn't have, you know, shirt and tie. And Alan said, you know, at first he thought, well, you know, he's some sort of Walter Mitty type. So, you know, he could have been a Walter, you know. but he was like a Walter Mitty type. That was Alan's first thought. But Alan said he saw him out on the street and confronted him, and supposedly the MIB said, Alan told me the MIB said, I'm a man in black in training. You know, which kind of a classic bizarre things that the MIB come out with. Now, Alan said that he would be willing to take the view of him today, you know, 40 years on, that this was just he really was just a Walter Mitty type character. But Alan said, you know, he pursued this guy around the corner of the street, and he was like 6 feet behind him. When he got around the corner, the guy was gone. You know, he said he was, I mean, literally gone. You know, and we do get a lot of that in the MIB stories, you know. So either people are mistaken and they're, you know, the MIB are hiding behind parked cars or whatever.
Yeah.
Or there's a, you know, there's something stranger going on, or it's both, you know. So.
All right, I'm going to put my, since Art Bell is back in the country, and I don't know, maybe he's going to start up his show again, I'll put on my Art Bell hat and say, Nick, what's the most frightening MIB story you've ever uncovered or heard? Like the most disturbing one. I like the coin disappearing one, but that's, I don't know, maybe it's the retelling is hardened it in my heart, and I'm not as disturbed by it. Can you think of any that are just like kind of so bizarre, they were just kind of unnerving?
Yeah, I mean, one of the strangest is one that's never really sort of... I mean, one of the things I wanted to do with the book, you know, I didn't want to go over old ground, which is why, you know, in the telling of the Barker Bender stories and the Keel stuff, you know, I specifically, rather than just borrowing 200 words from this book or that book...
Oh, no, you went out and got stuff that I hadn't heard and was, you know, instead of skipping over those chapters, I read them.
Yeah. That's why I wanted to interview a lot of new people, and certainly, you know, that applies to the cases. I wanted to, you know, make sure I included, you know, a huge amount of new material. And certainly one of the weirdest stories came from Colin Bennett.
Colin,
very well-known author. You know, he wrote what to me I think is probably the best book on Adamski, Looking for Orthon. It's a very balanced, study of Adamski. I think it's, to me at least, it's the best book on the Adamski puzzle or phenomenon, if you like, however you want to term it. But anyway, I mean, Colin told me about how in 1982, when he was living in London, he was walking home from the cinema late one night, kind of curiously, just like Albert Bender used to do, and he saw this weird light in the sky over London. He was living in the area of Notting Hill, London at the time, and he said this light then just literally transformed into like a British Royal Air Force Second World War Lancaster bomber, just hovering in the sky. And then it changed again into the form of like what today, you know, we would call a flying triangle. And, you know, he was just like transfixed, as anybody would be. You know, you wouldn't have to be involved in ufology to be transfixed if you saw a light change to a World War II bomber to a flying triangle. So clearly something weird was going on. So he raced home to tell his girlfriend, got up into the apartment upstairs, and as he did so, when he went in the room, there was like a literal man in black in the room, and sitting there on the couch talking to Colin's girlfriend.
In her apartment, or in their apartment?
Yeah, in their apartment. And the guy claimed that he'd come to visit the guy who lived upstairs, and he wasn't there, so he knocked on Colin's apartment, and his girlfriend had let him in. Which, again, you know, Colin asked her afterwards, you know, why on earth did you do that? And she had no answer. For some reason, the MIB almost immediately brought the conversation around, you know, well, where have you been, what have you been doing? And Colin felt, again, totally, you know, illogically spilled the beans on the UFO encounter, and the MIB just grilled him about the case. And when he was satisfied he got the answers, he left. When he went out the door, then Colin's common sense kicked in and thought, that was a man in black. So he chased after him, went out to the door, the guy was gone. And, you know, this sort of has a lot of weird aspects to it. The fact that, you know, Colin had seen this strange light in the sky. There was some sort of altered perception of something going on, at least. He raced home, and the MIB was already there. You know, that's even stranger. And then there were these facets that we see in Colin's case, that we see in the United States on the other side of the world. You know, the fact that no one gives any thought to letting these people in. They give no thought to spilling the beans on what happened. And they only go back to kind of normality when the MIB's gone, when it's too late to follow them. So that was certainly one of the strangest, and more for me significant, because, you know, it wasn't sort of steeped in the 50s and 60s. This was, you know, from the 80s, demonstrating it's sort of very much like an ongoing thing as well.
Yeah, it's, I mean, and you go through more and more cases, and it doesn't seem like things have changed a lot. And I think it seems like maybe the legend has taken hold and kept the imagery alive, either for whoever's doing it or forever paranormal thing is involved in it. And it's funny because you actually went into the couple stories, one by Lauren Coleman about a guy who bothered him when he was doing investigations, not of UFO things really related at all, but the Mattoon Gasser story and the Enema Bandit. I think actually Frank Zappa wrote a song about the Enema Bandit, but that's beside the point. That was going on in the 1970s, and he got a visit from somebody, I think Lauren did.
Yeah, this was an amazing story. You know, I mean, to get a Men in Black story from Lauren Coleman, you know, probably the world's most famous and respected cryptozoologist, you know.
Once again, things start to mix.
What's that?
I said, once again, things start to mix. Bigfoots and UFO encounters and poltergeists after abductions and things like that. Now suddenly Men in Black involved with a cryptozoology researcher. But continue.
Yeah, this is a weird story where Lauren was sort of got very interested in the whole story of the Mad Gasser of Mattoon. You know, this story to the 30s and 40s, well, actually 40s, where in Mattoon, Illinois, people were reporting this sort of dark-dressed man in a black hat who would, you know, the theory was he would kind of, you know, introduce like a knockout gas into somebody's house and then rob them or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But again, this has aspects of the Men in Black mystery as it relates to Albert Bendy, you know, somebody dressed in a dark suit and smelling overpowering brimstone-type smells in the house, and then they pass out, and, you know, whatever happens, happens. And Laura began looking into these stories, and also some sort of latter-day ones that paralleled it. And one of the weirder ones was a character named Michael Kenyon, who in December 1975 pleaded guilty to 6 counts of armed robbery, served 6 years in prison when he used to attack women from the 60s to the 70s and sort of like co-eds for the most part. And he would pick out particularly overweight women, he would sort of bind them and then give them enemas. I shouldn't laugh because he was, you know, I'm sure it's pretty traumatic for the person involved. That's what he did. And Lauren noticed there were some parallels, like the Mad Gasser of Mattoon, you know, mainly women who were attacked. It was like a strange experience in the house, you know, where they would be subjected to something or whatever. And so he began collecting information and began asking questions, you know, and things like this. And basically kind of contacting newspapers, sending newspapers, if anybody had any information, could they contact him? And what happened was that late one night, again, another aspect of the Men in Black phenomenon, Lauren got this knock at the front door of the home he was living at the time, And it was a man who identified himself as living with the Decatur, Illinois Police Department, identified himself as a detective, Lieutenant Applegate. And Applegate basically said, you shouldn't be doing this. It's going to draw more attention to what he's doing, et cetera, et cetera. And, the best thing you can do is walk away from the subject. And Lauren described, this guy as in typical kind of MIB proportion. He was dressed in a dark suit. He was extremely thin, and just looked very, very odd. And Lauren, after the guy had left, and Lauren's like, well, okay, I'll go along with what you said. So he called the police department a couple of days later. They didn't have a Lieutenant Applegate at all. Or Lieutenant, I should say, Applegate.
I understand what you're saying.
And Lauren found out later that Applegate, in some various literature, was like a synonym for the devil. So, it's like to hear this coming from Lauren, was a fascinating and amazing story. And I think most people, this is one of the more bigger talking points of the book, that people have, with that email, and they said, wow, I didn't know that Lauren had this experience. And it demonstrates, I guess, how the Men in Black mystery sometimes jumps from ufology, strictly, to other aspects of Fortiana as well. So.
Yeah, like I said, just like the phenomena does.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a chapter in the book about Men in Black sightings, or a Men in Black sighting at Loch Ness, Scotland, in the early 70s, where a researcher named Ted Holliday had been spending a lot of time at the Loch. Like a lot of people, began thinking, well, it's an unknown animal or a species of animal that science thinks have become extinct that still survives. But the more he dug into it, he started to get weird synchronicities. His camera would jam or pictures would come out fogged when he was trying to take photos of what he thought was the monster. And then he had this MIB experience at the Loch, where he saw this black-suited character staring menacingly at him, who just then literally vanished with a swish of wind at the same time. And at the same point in the very next year, at the same location, Holliday was knocked to the ground by a very serious heart attack. And he realized when the ambulance guys were stretching him away, this was exactly where the MIB was seen the previous year. And he came to believe that there was something deeply sort of paranormal about these lake monster type stories, that they weren't just unknown animals, if you like.
Yeah, and he wrote a book about it, the Dragon and the Disc book, right?
Yep, a good book. And also another good one, The Goblin Universe. That's a good one.
Yeah, that's one I haven't been able to find. Dragon and the Disc I have, and I read many, many, many years ago, to the point where I'd almost forgotten it until you brought him up in this book. Mm-hmm. Which is, it's funny, the more people stay in, not really, but a lot of people that stay in the subject for a long time, either cryptozoology or ufology, they get what some people might call a mystical bent or a paranormal bent to what they're looking at, and the flesh and blood nuts and bolts starts to fall away a bit.
Well, I mean, that's exactly what happened to me. I don't apologize for it. When I was a kid, Bigfoot was an unknown ape, the Loch Ness Monster was a plesiosaur, they were plesiosaurs, and UFOs were aliens, etc., etc. The more I kind of dug into it, the more I found that there was something deeply weird about the fact that Bigfoot never gets hit by a car, never bother it, nobody ever stumbles across just one corpse in the wood. I'm not asking for a million, just one.
No bones, nothing.
Nothing. And it's like with the lake monsters, the abundance or lack of abundance of food for a creature to, a colony of creatures to live on in Loch Ness, Loch Ness has a population of salmon and other fish. But, can it support, is there enough fish there to support constantly, like a viable colony of 15 to 20 animals, 20 to 30 feet long? That's one of the big questions. So, why should a Loch Ness researcher start to develop synchronicities?
Yeah.
It's things like this that have led me to realize, in my view at least, people disagree, and that's fine. That's what we have shows for and discussion groups. But in my view, I've come more around to the idea that somehow these things are interlinked. The phenomena kind of mimics things that we assume them to be. Kind of like aliens, they're always getting seen, or they were in the 50s, scene taking soil samples. You know, it's almost like a staged event.
Yeah.
Rather than people innocently stumbling over it. And that's why there's no doubt in my mind these phenomena are real. But I think they're staged phenomena sometimes, almost for our benefit. What that the reason is, that's the bigger issue. That's what's at the heart of the mystery we're still looking for. But, you know, my views have radically changed since I was like 21, you know, to now or whatever. So.
Yeah, well, mine too. And then, you know, have you had experience with this kind of with paranormal? I don't think I've ever asked you this. Have you had experience with paranormal type stuff happening as a result or during anything you're investigating,
yeah.
like strange phone calls or knocks on the walls or anything?
I've not had strange phone calls or knocks on the wall, but what I have had a lot of, and very often they're related to the things I'm researching at the time, is a lot of synchronicities.
Yeah.
Now, you know, everybody gets coincidences. You know, coincidences do happen, you know, and they're not, there's nothing meaningful about them. But, you know, when you're sort of really heavily involved in a particular issue. I mean, I got a lot of weird contactee-based synchronicities happen when I was researching the contactees book and when I was even promoting it, you know, just to the point where, I mean, actually, you know, that I set up a new blog just recently, that one, Nick's pick, 14 Picks of the Day, which,
yeah.
You know, you posted a few comments to. Well, you know, I mentioned there how I was reading an account of somebody who had an experience very similar to Truman Bethurum's contactee case or alleged contactee case with aliens, he said came from a planet called Clarion. And Dana, for people who don't know, Dana's my wife, she asked me if I could help her try and find her camera. And so I looked behind the TV, I didn't find the camera, but I found Dana's old yearbook from when she grew up in the Cayman Islands, although she's American, she actually grew up in the Cayman Islands, not the US. And the publishing company on the cover of the book is Clarion, you know. So
yeah.
It's kind of like I was reading all about this guy had a story similar to Truman Bethurum's story about aliens and Clarion. Within 2 minutes of finishing reading that, you know, I pick up a book which says Clarion on the title, which has nothing to do with aliens. You know, tremendous amounts of things like that have happened to me, weird synchronicities along those lines where, you know. I don't know what's at the heart of it or why, but it's happened. And that is sort of the thing that happens most of all when I've had what I do consider to be unexplained stuff is that for the most part, it's almost exclusively been synchronicities for me.
Yeah, well, this actually might lead into a discussion you and I could have that could go on for another 2 hours, but won't because you need to go to sleep, about the theories about what men, you know, what the source of the Men in Black thing might be.
Yeah.
Because you spend, I think, basically half the book almost. Well, yeah, about half the book.
Probably is about half the book, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Talking about what it, you know, what things might be. And a little earlier you said, well, it's probably all of these things. If somebody would said, if you think it was, do you think it's hoaxes or people making it up or hallucinations or... what, tulpas, manifested thought forms, you would just say yes.
Yeah, I think, you know, I wouldn't want people to think I don't believe there's a real phenomenon. I do. You know, I think there's a genuinely unknown paranormal MIB phenomenon. Now, this is dictated by how we define what paranormal is. You know, that's like a catch-all term.
Yeah.
You know, that's why in the book, you know, I think I cite maybe, I think I've got maybe 7 chapters on different theories. I mean, you know, the one that everybody thinks about because they tie it in with the, you know, the Will Smith, Tommy Lee Jones movies is the idea that they're government agents.
Yeah.
And, you know, I point out in the book that there are some cases where rumors started about somebody being visited by the Men in Black and then years later the files have been declassified under the terms of the Freedom of Information Act. And we can actually trace back and confirm that the person really did get a visit. I mean, I talk about a case in the book, a woman I interviewed who lives in England named Anne Henson. And Anne told me how she saw a UFO in the early 60s, contacted a UFO, an RAF, Royal Air Force Base, not too far away. They didn't respond, so she forgot about it. But then a week or two later, late one night, this guy turns up on the doorstep, black suit, no ID card, just identified himself as being with the military, no uniform, said just black suit, black car outside, And Anne had drawn these, like, compass drawings of the movement of the objects, and he expressed a lot of interest in these, asked if he could take them with him, promised to bring them back, which, of course, he never did, which is classic MIB characteristic. And also said, you know, well, there's no point in you telling anybody about it because nobody will believe you. You know, so it was like, it wasn't a direct threat, but it was kind of like he made the point that don't tell anyone. Now, that sounds like a typical Man in Black encounter. And without evidence, it would be, well, that's interesting, but it is just another one to add to the list. But Anne's story is very different because a few years ago, under the terms of the Freedom of Information Act, the British Ministry of Defence released a bunch of files from 1962-63, which is when Anne's encounter occurred. Hers was in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
And the case file, which is about 9 pages long, on Anne's encounter is in the file. And it actually identifies the guy who came to visit her as a Sergeant J.W. Scott, attached to the British Royal Air Force's Provost and Security Services. And the Provost and Security Services are basically the British equivalent of the Air Force Office of Special Investigations over here.
Uh-huh.
You know, they get involved in counterintelligence, espionage, all sorts of things like that. So, you know, some MIB, there's no doubt, are government people. Now, of course, you know, there are also some cases which are hoaxes. You know, people hoax things for obscure reasons, you know. I mean, you know, studies have been done on the motivations behind hoaxing, and some of them are so... they're so fascinating because they're the sort of things you just wouldn't think about. You know, so there are motivations for people hoaxing various phenomena. And, of course, there's, you know, there's innocent case people being mistaken for the MIB. I mean, I have a kind of an amusing story involving a well-known paranormal researcher, Micah Hanks.
Yeah.
Micah lives in North Carolina, just outside Asheville. And there's a big famous hotel there, sort of very upscale hotel, which has a lot of ghost stories attached to it. And, you know, Mike is into ghost stories as well. And so sometimes on a Saturday night, he'd go over there with all his ghost hunting equipment, you know, and temperature gauges and all that sort of stuff. And he told me how he said, when I interviewed him, he said, you know, because it was an upmarket hotel, I always felt it was better to put a suit on when I'd go there. You know, I'd be wandering around the corridors like 10 o'clock at night with his black suit on, and pointing all these weird gadgets and equipment at different parts of the corridors and doorways.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they'd have meetings, you know, in town, ghost hunting groups and paranormal groups, and word started to get around, have you heard about this man in black wandering the corridors of the hotel with all these weird devices? And Mike had realized after hearing these, it was like, well, hang on, they're actually talking about me. You know, so by default, he became part of the MIB mythology, and you know, it's only the fact that he was able to lay the matter to rest. If he hadn't have been able to, you know, this would have become a definitive story, you know, along the lines of Albert Bender getting the visit, you know, the man in black of the haunted hotel at Asheville. You know, it would have become part of that. Now, in saying that, you know, when we rule out the military cases, the legitimate ones, the hoaxing, the mistaken identity, we're still left with a core percentage of cases which are very, very weird. And, you know, this is where I sort of address these ideas more. You know, the tulpa idea, you know, could some of these things be like constructed thought forms? You know, the idea is the tulpa is essentially a creation of the human mind, but, you know, you focus on it to such a deep extent, possibly, you know, using... you know, substances to really get yourself into an altered state of mind where you focus on this imagery. You possibly get yourself into like a trance-like state, and, you know, night after night you engage in ritual to strengthen the imagery in your mind of this creature or entity or whatever.
Yeah.
To the point where it then becomes externalized. You know, you kind of give birth to a mind monster, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the theories about tulpas, which are, you know, they're primarily like a Tibetan sort of belief system originally, is that they thrive and survive on high states of human emotion, kind of like an emotional vampire would be the best way to describe them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people say, or that the theory, if they're tulpas, if the MIB are tulpas, maybe the silencing of people isn't actually the motivation. Maybe the motivation is to provoke a high state of anxiety in the person, that the MIB then, you know, in simplistic terms, bleed dry. You know, in other words, the instilling of the fear, people think it's, you know, they don't want people to talk about UFOs, is a ruse. The whole point of it could be to create a high state of emotion. That's the real goal. Now, a number of people have said that, you know, when the MIB have gone, they felt drained. They felt like a diabetic about to crash or whatever, you know,
yeah,
just to pass two meals. And one of the other weird things, you know, drawing the vampire parallels, you know, in the sort of black cloak vampire draining somebody of blood and the Tulpa MIB draining somebody of energy, one of the other parallels is that the men in black, for the most part, stand on the doorway waiting to be invited in, which is, and they don't come in until they are invited, which is very similar, you know, to the old tales of vampires that won't enter your house until you give them the invite. So, you know, I have to wonder sometimes, are some of these ancient vampire legends, you know, based on early encounters with, you know, sort of proto-MIB type characters? You know, is there that much difference between a black cloaked vampire, you know, draining somebody of blood in legend versus a black-suited MIB, Tulpa-style MIB, you know, feeding on the emotion of the witness? You know, it's a far-out theory. But, I mean, a lot of people, including me, you know, have a lot of time for Tulpa-type phenomena. I think it is a legitimate phenomenon. I think, you know, you can kind of, you know, push things out the boundaries of the imagination and they can stride right into the real world.
Yeah, or there's something there that you or a group of people have basically formed as a piece of clay, you know, maybe a psychic bit of clay, or even more importantly, formed by your expectations, so that your, what's the word, so that your senses have in front of it what your subconscious expects to be there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this sort of crosses over into sort of several different areas where it's sort of, it may not just be Tulpa-like, it may be sort of quasi-Tulpa-like, where, for example, you know, one of the things that you dug into deeply, the idea there's a genuine phenomenon, but it manifests according to the subconscious beliefs of the person. You know, somebody in the 50s would assume aliens look like us with long blonde hair, so that's how they appear.
Yeah.
You know, so it is pulling on the person's mindset and externalizing it, but maybe it's an already existing phenomenon, you know, like a chameleon. It just changes its color or whatever to suit the person. So.
Yeah, well, either that or your subconscious has access to some sort of database, either within itself or somewhere where these images reside, where if you want to start talking about a collective unconscious or something like that, and your mind will use those to reconcile what's in front of you. Or, you know, for that matter, it can be an outside force, and that's recursive with your expectation, and it kind of goes back and forth as a kind of a subconscious conversation before it gets to your conscious awareness and memory, you know?
Yeah. My personal view is that at least a part of it is external. I think there is a genuine paranormal phenomenon that, you know, may account for a lot of weird things, you know, that we experience. And that, mm-hmm. but you're right, I think it is... It's sort of, you know, its appearance, at least as we see it, you know, is very much dictated by what we expect to see or what we think unconsciously we should see. I think there's a lot to be said for that. But I mean, you know, this kind of ties in one of the other things I talk about in the book, the whole trickster angle. You know, I interviewed Chris O'Brien, you know, who's sort of a well-known expert on the trickster phenomenon, because a number of cases of MIB seem to have this sort of curious, almost playfully malevolent trickster angle to them as well. You know, and if you go back into sort of the Middle Ages in England and Europe.
Just like Albert Bender's playful malevolence.
Yeah, you know, it's like fairies back then. You know, people, you talk about fairies today, people talk of the imagery as of sort of little female characters with wings.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't want people to think I believe in literal fairies. I don't. but people ask me, do I believe back then people were seeing things that they perceived as falling into the, what back then they were classed as fairies, they probably were. But if you go back and look at the folklore, back then they weren't sort of little ethereal, you know, lightweight creatures with wings. They were sort of, they were the definitive little people, goblins, sprites, mm-hmm. You know, that would invade your house in the middle of the night, that could be trickster-like, they could be playful. But if you cross their path, they could be downright malevolent. You know, they would steal babies and leave changelings, carve wooden effigies. Mm-hmm. You know, so there are parallels with some alien abductions and hybrid type things.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think all this kind of ties in with the MIB, you know, the cultural imagery of whether the man in black or 500 years ago, the sinister guy in a black cloak rides into town on a black horse, you know, and he's viewed as being the devil. There's probably not much difference, you know, it's just a cultural reflection on internal fears, which are externalized, and maybe something paranormal picks up on those externalized fears and then manifests according to them.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I would be the very first to suggest that a lot of the paranormal and what we're talking about here tonight is external in nature, to the percipient, to the witness, to whoever. But the important part, the part we have to really be careful of and pay attention to, is what you were saying, which is our perception of it and how how it's processed through our minds. Have there been any MIB cases where there's more than one witness and then that the two people see slightly different things, or is it pretty much straight down the line? Because there obviously have been abduction and UFO witness type things where people time and time again have described sometimes widely varying things that they've seen.
Well, you know, I mean, that's interesting because we do have cases where more than one person has seen an MIB. For example, you know, Jim Moseley and Tim Beckley.
Yeah, and Colin
Alan
Bennett
Greenfield.
And his girlfriend.
But the MIBs where there are more than one witness, they're dressed in the black suits, but they're not the weird-looking MIBs. You know, they just look like government people, or they look like regular people, but dressed in black. Where we have the weirder MIB, you know, these sort of emaciated, pale-skinned, you know, skinny, anorexic-looking ones with sort of the bulging eyes that they hide behind, you know, sort of wraparound sunglasses.
The goth MIB.
Almost exclusively, they only appear to one person. And that makes me wonder to what extent the experience actually occurs in a physical realm or not, or really if the person's mind has been, you know, affected. You know, it's like Albert Bender. When you read his accounts, if you read it with an open mind and you look at, you know, his beliefs, his anxieties, the possibility of him having some sort of, you know, glitch of the mind at certain occasions when they would appear, it's pretty much clear from reading it that, you know, he was talking about experiences that were like visionary in an altered state of mind. So in other words, I have to wonder how many of these other weird MIB experiences may have occurred not in sort of physical 3D reality, but in a case where the person's mind literally was, you know, tampered with, and it was a visionary matrix type experience, but provoked by something external, but not literally like by a knock on the front door, so to speak.
Yeah, it's fortuitous or something that we bring this up because have you ever, and I mentioned this on the couple of weeks ago on the show, my friend Don Newcomer lent me a book called Conjuring Up Philip. Have you ever heard of that book?
The Philip experiments where they created this in the mind, the image of this character, and gave him a background and a history and everything else.
Yeah, exactly. Because the stuff that you're talking about and you've been mentioning during the show and actually through a lot of paranormal, whatever you want to call it, ghost, Bigfoot, UFO stuff, their experiment really impinges upon this because if people don't know this, what they did was, like Nick said, they made up a character. They made up a historical figure, this group, this Toronto paranormal group in, I think, 1972 or 3. They made up a character and they gave him a life, a period that he lived. They made up a biography for him and that he'd killed himself over, you know, a mistress and et cetera, et cetera. And then they started doing seances where they tried to call the person up that they'd made up. And they all knew they'd made him up. And to their surprise, after a few weeks or I guess maybe a few months, they started getting noises and wrappings and things in the table as seances used to do, where the people in seances and spiritualist gatherings used to do. And they had completely made the person up. And the funny thing was that they would ask the yes and no questions. They would ask this entity, whatever it was, that they made up questions about the period. And he got a lot of the historical things wrong, which are things that he should have obviously known if he lived in the time. Because they'd go and look it up later to see if the answers are right, and invariably a lot of them weren't.
Yeah.
So they were saying, well, we think that anybody can make up something like this, and it's more a creation of our collective wish to have it here, but it manifests as a paranormal entity, as people think that ghosts are, whatever. And they're not saying, well, let's throw everything out, but let's really start to look at what we think that the paranormal is, or what the psychokinesis is, or seances are, or anything like this. Or, you know, they even get into hauntings and things like that. But it really has a lot of implications in the UFO and UFO field and the Men in Black thing that we've been talking about.
Yeah, you're right. And I think the really interesting stuff starts when whatever this thing that we create in our imagination, like the Philip experiments, when it starts to potentially act independently.
And that has happened too.
Yeah, and I think that could account for the MIB, you know, the idea that we create this imagery. And, you know, it is kind of like an iconic image, you know, the guys in the black suits and the trench coats, sunglasses and, you know, the fedoras. It's become part of popular culture.
Yeah.
You know, that imagery is so powerful. Maybe it has really given birth, you know, to a particular paranormal phenomenon that's kind of became tenacious of life and wanting to hang on to it, you know, and when it's feeding time, it's time to knock on somebody's door, you know, to bleed that person dry or whatever. So.
Yeah, well, it's reflected in the popular culture, too. You were talking about fairies. Remember remember Peter Pan? If you don't believe in Tinkerbell, she dies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's like a classic Tolpa thing, you know, you don't believe in these things. They have no power, and they start to fragment. And maybe that's with the Men in Black, why sometimes they act so strange, because they don't aware of our customs, they can't eat properly, they start to slow down and lose energy, they stand up and their legs are wobbling. Maybe, you know, that they're actually fragmenting out of existence, you know, and they until they get their insulin shot or whatever, you know, the equivalent. So.
Yeah, that's what reminded me. When you said there was a single percipient, there was this kind of emaciated, confused entity that would show up. And does that mean that there's, you know, does that mean there's less people around to believe in it and it loses its power? That's what cued me to that when you mentioned that.
Yeah, I actually addressed that in the book. I think, you know, the idea that there are certain times when different paranormal phenomena is far more popular than others. Maybe that's why today we see less Space Brothers and more Greys, because the phenomenon may not have changed, but the way it manifests and appears has. You know, maybe the Greys and the Space Brothers are one and the same. It's just the way we see them has changed, because we don't believe in long-haired aliens from Venus anymore, but we're more inclined to believe in emotionless insects from, you know, however many light years away.
Yeah, that's been written, I think, extensively. I think Bruce Duensing and even Colin Bennett, I believe, has written about on that theme as well, that the whatever is being shown. And, of course, you know, Valet, Keel, Keith Thompson, I think, other people like that brought it up years ago in a simpler form, that if you look at the phenomenon and you look at what's going on, it seems, and Mosley says this too, it seems to go through fads and phases, and you don't see certain things for a while until a new idea or a meme pops up, and then everybody sees those things stepping out of ships or walking into bedrooms or walking through the forest or whatever it might be.
And I think this may be why, you know, it's like, for example, if you look at the Men in Black mystery, you know, I pointed out one of these things where one of the classic aspects in terms of the witness is that their common sense aspects of their brain is just kind of rewired, or, you know, just put on hold. Now, of course, you know, when we dream, you know, I mean, you know,
right. responsible for.
Hey, Nick, you're. Are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yeah, it's you fuzzed out for a second there, and I couldn't understand why.
Oh, okay. Yeah, what I was just saying, you know, with the MIB witnesses, they often talk about how it seems like their common sense abilities just go out the window. You know, they invite the MIB in, they forget to ask for ID. They don't realize the illogical issue of letting three guys in the house at midnight. Now, one of the important things is, if this is some sort of something internal to the human mind, matrix-like almost, you know, we have to remember that when we're in the dream state, we dream things that in the dream sound totally logical. But then when we wake up, the some of the things we dreamt about are totally illogical. You know, like somebody might dream about falling off a building, and then they get up and they run off. Well, the logical part of your mind should tell you that, you know, you're not going to fall off a 400-foot building and get up and run off. But in your dream, you do. That's because the logical part of the brain isn't that active in the dream state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so maybe that's what we're seeing in MIB-type experiences, that if it is kind of like a trance-like experience rather than a physical experience, then maybe, you know, that explains why only part of the brain is involved, and the factors, the aspects of the brain that, you know, we would normally use in such a situation just aren't present.
It's one thing I did think of when you were mentioning people's sort of their critical thinking being shut off, at least in regards to their personal safety or whatever you want to call it, during these encounters was the, and this didn't really happen in the United States, but with the phantom social worker thing that happened in England in the 80s, 70s and 80s, was it?
Yeah.
People would let these people in that were asking the very personal questions about children in the household.
Yeah, that's right. This was sort of really in the 80s in England. You know, people would talk about a woman would turn up on the doorstep and, you know, flash an ID card, said she was from like a social worker from the government, and, you know, there being claims of abuse or something in the family, and they were here to investigate them. And, you know, but they would ask all sorts of weird and intrusive questions and just odd questions that didn't seem to have anything to do. You know, how many rooms are in the house? And, you know, have you had any strange dreams about seeing triangles in your sleep and things like that? And they come across like MIB type stories, you know, that somebody, a weird person turns up, flashes an ID card, claims to be from the government, investigating this or that, and then when checks are made, the person doesn't work there and there's no way to track them down. You know, it is very much like a very closely parallels, you know, the Men in Black stories.
Yeah. So what are those people doing? There's no paranormal thing going on there, really. They haven't witnessed anything. It just seems to center on children, which is kind of strange.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, this is kind of like, I mean,
and a little disturbing. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. The phantom social worker stories are deeply disturbing, you know, because people inevitably look at the person who got visited and wonder, you know, well, were they abusing their kids? Do you know what I mean? It's like one of those things where it's like telling someone not to think of a pink elephant.
Right.
The first thing you think of is a pink elephant.
Or making it, or Lyndon Johnson's thing of accusing somebody of something and making them deny it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and I think the one thing about the phantom social workers, that what it has in common with the Men in Black, is that the witness finds it profoundly disturbing, and it has like a lasting effect where they don't forget it, you know, and it kind of does kind of almost make them paranoid for a while, you know. They see menacing figures in the shadows or whatever, you know, or is that woman who's looking at them across the street another one of these people, or is it just a woman thinking she sees somebody she knows, you know, wondering whether to say hello or not or whatever. So.
Yeah, that's
one of the things I've found is that, you know, these experiences, these weird people knocking on the door, they do have a very negative, lasting effect on the people.
Yeah, in what way? Besides just the normal, that was frightening.
Paranoia, you know, a fear that they're going to come back, almost like the sense that, you know, if somebody's house is broken into, it's like the violation of somebody going through all their private stuff. You know,
post-traumatic stress kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, very similar to that. And, you know, that we get that in a lot of MIB cases where the person just feels, you know, sort of violated and disturbed and, you know, that there was just something very wrong about the whole, you know, manner of an operation of these people. You know, there's just something unsettling about it.
There's one other chapter I don't think we touched on. Well, there's two, actually. One is about the time traveler theory, and one is, the very last one, the demons and the occult theory.
Yeah, I mean the time travel one's kind of like a fun, interesting one, and granted, to a great degree, you know, it's speculative, and it's based on whether or not, obviously, time travel is possible.
Yeah.
And I interviewed Josh Warren, a well-known paranormal researcher and author, and Josh has looked into, you know, Men in Black stories quite deeply. Uh-huh. And one of the questions that Josh has asked is, you know, why do they wear black suits? You know, why do they wear old-style black suits, old-style hats? Why do they drive like 1950s Lincolns or whatever?
Yeah.
Chevy. You know,
yeah, even up into the 80s and beyond, actually.
Yeah, you know, it's like they haven't upgraded their motif. And, you know, Josh speculated on the idea. Granted, if time travel's real, you know, could it be ironically the case that they're not our worst nightmare? Might they be actually something like time cops, you know, whose job it is to prevent time paradoxes from happening? You know, if the UFO phenomenon has nothing to do with aliens, but is, you know, some far-flung aspect of the human race coming back here, mm-hmm. and occasionally things go wrong, maybe that's why MIB is seen in UFO experiences, you know, in Josh's idea. Maybe a UFO mission comes back, you know, perhaps, you know, speculated the idea that perhaps the human race is on a waning streak in the future. They come back to take DNA under the guise of being aliens. Something goes wrong at some point. So then the MIB, the time cops have to step in to, you know, fix the time paradox. And it's a great sci-fi scenario. The big question is, you know, could it sort of translate into reality? You know, that's a big question.
But in
terms of a theory, it's an interesting one because it does account for a lot of stuff, I guess.
Yeah, well, that it also assumed that you think that time is linear.
Yes, yeah.
And that you can have to go back and forward on one track of time instead of the, you know, every possibility at once. Then it doesn't really matter as much. Anyway, that's...
Yeah, I mean, actually, you know, Josh brought up the whole issue of the famous Thunderbird photograph, you know, this the 1800s, where countless paranormal researchers, you know, said they saw this photograph, like, in the early 60s from, you know, either, like, Fate or Argosy or True Magazine, you know, one of these early 60s magazines that people like Keel used to write for.
Yeah.
Saw this photograph of this huge, monstrous bird, sort of dead bird, nailed to a door in a barn somewhere in the U.S., and today, no one could find the photograph, but numerous people said they saw it.
I saw that picture. It was a bunch of guys holding it up. Is that different?
Well, now go and try and find it. That's a big thing.
I remember seeing a picture with a bunch of guys dressed in 1800s, like Western outfits, standing in front of a barn door, like five or six or eight of them holding up this giant bird that looks like it's like 20, 30 feet wide.
Yeah, well, that's the one, but the problem is, people can't find it. And there have been a few big creations, but the original one can't be found. You know, Josh's theory is, well, maybe some sort of time paradox happened, and the people really did see that in the magazine, but then somebody goes back, manipulates the timeline so the relevant magazine never gets the picture, and then in a future timeline or a parallel one, the picture vanishes, or the picture was never published. But contrary to sci-fi, where, you know, you change the past and it changes everything about the future, maybe it doesn't. That's why the people still have the memories of seeing it, you know. But, you know, it's an interesting theory, put it that way. But yeah, the other one you talked about, you know.
The demons and...
The demonology theory. I mean, as you know, you know, there are a lot of people who honestly, you know, fully believe that, you know, the UFO phenomenon is like a deceptive demon... Well, literally a demonic deception, you know.
That's
what there's no alternative for them for that theory. Mm-hmm. The idea that we're sort of being set up for Armageddon and, you know, the aliens are really demons in disguise and they're going to instigate the return of, you know, the rising of the Antichrist, etc. And, you know, it'll all be done under an alien deception. And again, you know, that there are a few things that made people believe this, you know, that we see prevalent in a number of MIB cases. For example, a number of people who had fairly profound MIB experiences, including Albert Bender, were also heavy users of Ouija boards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and other people have claimed extensive poltergeist activity in the home in the wake of MIB activity. Now, you know, some people have quite rightly pointed out to me that some, you know, people who are into UFOs aren't always just into UFOs. They might be into ghost stories or Bigfoot or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I'm into cryptozoology as well as UFOs. I'm not really big on ghosts and things, but there are people who are.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, does the fact that somebody happens to use a Ouija board and they're into UFOs, does that, and they see the Man in Black, does that mean there's necessarily a connection? You know, I don't personally think we can make that leap other than to say it's interesting, you know. And, I mean, the poltergeist activity, I don't know why the people do report it, you know. But again, it's if just because they report it, we have to look at the issue of, well, what is poltergeist activity, you know.
Right.
It's, is it something internal, you know, is it external, is that a bit of both? You know, again, I think all options are open when it comes to the Men in Black, and, you know, we've just sort of discussed kind of six or seven theories here,
yeah.
You know, government, mistaken identity, hoaxing, demons, time travelers, tulpas, tricksters. And there's probably a few more that I didn't include. And maybe to some degree, you know, whatever the occult is, whatever the paranormal is, whatever this real phenomenon is, you know, they all come into play somehow, and it's our beliefs as to what they actually are. You know, one person's demon is another person's time traveler, is another person's alien, you know, that we all have our own names for a phenomenon that I don't think we've really fully understood what it is yet, other than that different cultures and mythologies have tried to label it, and those labels have become belief systems.
Yeah, well, it is, you know, if you get far enough into this, you realize you have to get to the point where point of view and what's the word? Well, just people's belief systems are really heavily affecting how they look at, they put their own template on these things. And, you know, and it's no different than Men in Black, it seems like. And that maybe that's whatever's causing that, that may be just, you know, it's fine with that. As long as people can't really agree on what it is, it can do what it needs to do, whether that be evil or be curious about us or just be a manifestation of our, you know, collective idea of what it is, whatever it might be.
I think it's probably the latter. I mean, you know, it's like with Albert Bender. You know, if he really was concerned, as he may legitimately have been, that he was going to get a visit, you know, from the government, he would inevitably view that from a negative perspective. You know, they're not going to come along and say, "Hey, Albert, how's it going, mate?" You know, it's going to be the exact opposite. So, in other words, if he was anticipating the government was going to turn up and it was going to be a stressful thing for him, maybe that would have, you know, that would obviously have a reaction on how possibly maybe a genuine unknown phenomenon that he interacted with, why it manifested in such a negative fashion, because he was primed to only kind of view it negatively, you know.
Right.
What's interesting is that, you know, the MIB in Bender's life went away when he met his girlfriend and got married.
Yeah. What a surprise.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, when he's not obsessing and you know, getting all anxious about UFOs and having a normal life as well, or instead, you know, they retreat into the background and they finally fade away. And one of the other interesting things is that when the MIB took Bender, you know, he tells a very weird story, which again is clearly altered state driven in my mind. He claims to have been taken to Antarctica. And one of the things that the aliens told him was that they'd done something to him which would now make him free of cancer forever. He would never develop cancer. Now, he already had this long-standing fear of developing it. And to me, this could only have been his subconscious finding a way to, you know, free him of this constant worry about developing cancer, you know. And so, but he put it onto the aliens. And maybe that, maybe something really manifested and told him, you're not going to develop cancer. But maybe it was just internal to him, you know. And but it was so powerful an imagery that, you know, he viewed it as being something that really had cured him or prevented him from ever developing it.
Yeah. Yeah, who knows? I got one final question I forgot to ask you at the beginning. You know, Bender finally said that something had told him to not talk, or the aliens or somebody had come to him and said that you, the Men in Black, had come to him and said, you've solved the UFO question, and we know you have, but you can't tell anybody. In fact, if you do tell anybody, horrible things will happen to you. So that's why he disbanded the International Flying Saucers Bureau. Do you think that's due to what you just said now, that he was reconciling all this stuff in his mind? Or do you think that somebody from somewhere just decided they'd had enough of him making noise and just scared the pants off him and just told him what they thought he wanted to hear?
Well, I think it could be a bit of both. You know, I think the human mind, complex thing, and if we can kind of project imagery, it could be a bit of both. You know, maybe for Bender, maybe he really did get a knock on the door from somebody who was following the sort of guidelines of the Robertson panel.
Yeah.
You know, and scared him to death, flashed an ID card and said, you know, what are you doing digging into flying saucers? You know, demanded asked questions about his patriotism and all this sort of stuff. You know, that probably would, back then, the early 50s, you know, probably scare the life out of him.
Yeah.
And maybe also, you know, that amped up the paranoia for him that he was being watched. And then, you know, it's clear that I think there seemed to be some altered state stuff going on where there were these very close parallels between certain types of epilepsy that Bender reported, that, you know, that then these things in his mind, you know, got intermingled with his subconscious and possibly intermingled with some other intelligence that possibly got its grips into when he went looking for it, you know, and it was just a complete jumble where there really was a truth to his experience, but it's so sort of couched in what was internal, what was external, what may have been related to a real government visit, interlinked with, you know, this phenomenon that we know exists but we don't really understand, sucking all this out of his subconscious and internal worries and then throwing it back at him, you know, in the form of Three Men in Black. So.
Yeah, I kind of thought along the same lines, but we've known each other for so long that eventually we just kind of keep completing each other's sentences. However, I did want to say before we finished here that after reading the book, or most of the book, I haven't read completely all the way to the end. You might have been able to tell, Nick, that I think that anybody listening, anybody wants to get the book, it should be consider ourselves lucky that Nick wrote this book and not somebody else, because it's very well done and it's extremely thorough pretty. I mean, it's as well balanced as I think it could be, and it's a real good examination of something that people sort of thought they knew about, but when you read the book, you realize that there's more facets to it than you thought there were, even if you've been into the subject for years. So thanks so much, Nick.
Appreciate that, Greg. Thank you.
All right. And when the next one comes out, we'll have you on when the book comes out instead of months afterwards. I'll make that request right now.
All right. Well, it's no problem. I'll make sure they fire a copy your way when it comes out then.
What's the new one again?
It's actually about, I think it's like 5 days before Christmas. So you might want to leave it a couple of weeks. I'm sure most people won't want to be listening to UFO stuff over Christmas. Certainly, I probably won't.
So. All right. Well, we'll talk to you at least on the show when that comes out, and certainly before that. And I hope that you can make it out to the West Coast before then on some sort of assignment, and we can hang out.
Well, yeah. I mean, if people are interested, I'm speaking in LA.
Oh, that's right.
It's the final Saturday in September and the first Sunday in October. It's the Conscious Life Expo, which I forget actual location, but if people type in Conscious Life Expo,
I think it's the LA airport.
Oh, okay, but it's anyway, it's and I'm doing a workshop
one of the hotels there.
Black and at that conference. I don't know which day yet, but it'll be the Saturday or the Sunday anyway. So.
All right. Any other upcoming things or self-promo you would like to do?
Yeah, I'm speaking at a conference called the Cryptid Fest the week after next in Oklahoma, where I'm speaking about the sort of paranormal aspects of cryptozoology. So I'm going to be talking about the Loch Ness MIB cases and the MIB links to Mothman and things like that. So.
People in cryptozoology need to hear that, because I think the paranormal contingent as opposed to the zoological contingent is very small, and I think that needs to change.
Yes. Yeah, I had an entertaining debate on Crypto Mundo about 3 months ago where collectively there must have been about 200 comments where I think you know, there was me versus everybody else.
What know, is this mumbo jumbo?
Yeah, it was mainly, you know, fair play to them. People stood up for their beliefs that they think Bigfoot's a flesh and blood animal, and I stood up to say why I don't think it's just a flesh and blood animal. I think there's something strange about Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And I think, really, if we're honest, you know, if we can get away from the emotional-driven belief system and rationally debate as to why Bigfoot never gets hit by a car versus, well, maybe there's so few of them, or is it just, you know, it's beyond lucky, you know, it's just too lucky.
Yeah.
So there has to be something else. If you can really rationally debate it, we'd ever actually get somewhere. But when everything is so emotionally driven to knock this person's theory down or that person's theory down purely and simply because it goes against what somebody else says, we don't, too much energy is expended on doing that versus, you know, just trying to properly resolve it.
Well, what most arguments and discussions, unfortunately, consist of is waiting for the other person to be done, if you're polite, and not waiting for the other person to be done, if you're not, so you can say what you want to say. Not really listening to what they say.
Mm-hmm.
And then nobody learns anything, least of all, the somebody who might be reading the thread and getting more and more annoyed with it, or listening to it on the radio, or seeing it on TV, or whatever. Debate has lost it's a lost art form, I think, and it's a really valuable learning tool, and people just use it as a way to bash each other over the head with chairs, figuratively, unfortunately.
No, you're right, and I think one of the big problems with stuff like, whether it's ufology, cryptozoology, ghost hunting, is the fact that, you know, these types of debates do go on. What it tells us a lot about the nature and the power of belief systems on the human mind. And what it also tells us is that despite what we think we know about these phenomena, we haven't really learned much at all. All we've done is collected more and more reports, but we haven't got more and more answers.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, that's what these sort of debates tell us, is that we're still pretty much in the dark, and because we're in the dark, we've developed theories, you know, and and granted, you know, to an extent, we all do that, you know.
Of course we all do it, but a lot of people choose to not realize that they're shoving all the data that's been collected into a belief system and ignoring huge swaths of it that don't fit into the belief system, and then standing there on top of the hill knocking everybody down that comes up that says, well, what about these 15 cases over here? Shut up. Those are irrelevant. It's like, you're not even listening.
You do get that in cryptozoology. I mean, there are a lot of reports of Bigfoot, you know, as I said, people swore they shot it, you know. And people draw the parallels when, for example, people say, well, most people don't see mountain lions, but they're out there. But the point is, some people do see mountain lions.
Yes.
And some people, eventually, a mountain lion is killed and classified, or it's put in a zoo, or if it's a threat to a particular area, the police go out and finally, on some occasions, they shoot it.
Yeah.
But Bigfoot elude capture, death, shooting on 100% of every occasion.
Yes.
And that's the problem. I don't have any problem with Bigfoot being so skillful to elude us 99% of the time. I have a big problem with him doing it 100% of the time.
Or a lizard man, or a chupacabras, or the Loch Ness monster, or the monkey man in India, or.
Yeah, it's just the list goes on. And, you know, you can apply that to UFOs, and people say, well, they've crashed. Yeah, but all the debris is always inconclusive, and nobody's got a body to, outside of the government at least. So, you know, the evidence there is as elusive as anything else. So.
Right. Yeah, well, it's just like the late Bud Hopkins says that he thinks he, and I heard him say this in 88 or 89, that the all of this stuff is leading us kicking and screaming into some sort of new worldview and some sort of new way of examining things. And, you know, for all the things I don't disagree with him on, I think that's one of the best things he ever said. And that's your book does that, too. I mean, if you look at it dispassionately, you realize there's so much we don't know, not only about the Men in Black thing, but about how we perceive it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, that was a very good point that Bud made. I think, you know, it's important to realize that, you know, we think we're seeing these things just because they're visiting or they're here or whatever. You know, maybe, you know, it really is to teach us to learn, you know, for us to understand something. The trick is, you know, if we don't understand it, we don't learn from it in the way we're supposed to, whatever that might be, it's just going to continue. You know, people 200 years from now are still going to see a weird creature run across the road in front of the headlights, or, you know, someone's going to have a weird encounter with some strange little creature that manifests in the bedroom at 3 a.m. You know, it'll never change unless, I guess, we understand what it is we're supposed to understand. So.
Yes. The idea is, and you and I have discussed this, is that the UFO thing and everything we've been talking about is nowhere near a solution until somebody from outside the UFO and paranormal thing makes a discovery about science or perception or psychology that we don't know about yet.
Yeah. I think, you know, put me on the spot and say, what do I think's going on? I really do believe there's an external intelligence, but it, as you believe too, that somehow it interacts with our perceptions and beliefs and manifests according to those perceptions and beliefs. But the big question, you know, that's something I fully believe.
Mm-hmm.
But the big question is, why is he doing it?
Yeah, you know? Why? And why, how, and then, you know, the most importantly, like you said, is why. Then how and where.
I mean, somebody might say, you know, it's to teach us, it's to elevate us. Somebody might just say, it's fucked up insane. You know what I mean? And it's just playing with us, or it's got nothing better to do because it's bored stiff, you know.
Yeah, it's the trickster thing, actually.
Yeah. It's like, you know, what am I going to do? What I'll do. That guy, I'll pick that guy over there, and I'll, you know, Bigfoot's going to run across the road in front of him, and then when he gets home, there's going to be a man in black on the doorstep. You know what I mean? It's like...
Yeah, it reminds me of Peter Cook in Bedazzled, where he's just going around messing with people just because he thinks it's funny, and that's his job.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think, you know, the reasoning behind these sort of things, we tend to look at them from what we might do. You know, the big question is, maybe we are, like some people have said, you know, maybe we're dealing with something that's totally insane.
Yeah, the Charles Fort thing, if there's a universal mind, must it necessarily be sane?
Yeah, you know, and it could be something like that, you know. So you imagine some deranged computer or whatever, you know, that just dishes out bizarre stuff for the sake of it, or the programs just run wild, you know.
Yeah, or for that matter, is our calling it insane, does that mean we're sane and it's not? I mean, it comes back to point of view again, too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this sort of, you know, I think the just, you know, to come back to the Men in Black, I think the Men in Black mystery actually opens the doorway. If you look at it carefully, it opens the door to a lot of discussion on issues that go far beyond just, is it government agents? You know, this whole, you know, feeding on fear, whether or not it's, you know, an internal perception or a visionary type experience, and what that can mean for other aspects of the paranormal as well. You know,
right.
I think you can actually learn a lot from studying MIB accounts.
Uh-huh.
To go far beyond the MIB mystery, really.
Yeah, and it goes into, just as we were discussing, what we think, why we think it, how we process it, what we're afraid of, why, all this stuff.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the iconic image as well has a major role to play in all this. You know, that sort of the fedora hat, the turn-up trench coat collar.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like this, it's a mixture of like 1950s gumshoe detective and you know, some Al Capone gangster movie, and, you know, and that sort of Rat Pack image, G-Men, you know, all mixed into one sort of thing. So.
Yeah, and it's a product of that time. The funny thing is that that image just has been holding on for so long.
Mm-hmm.
Why does that image hold on and doesn't, like, evolve into somebody that looks like, you know, Robert Smith coming to your door and scaring you, you know?
Yeah. that would be quite funny, actually, if that did happen. But, you're right. It's everything is sort of, you know, steeped in the past, but also steeped in ensuring that the MIB is so memorable. You know, maybe that's part of it.
Yeah, that's true. It's an enduring piece of folklore and an enduring story and experience, you know, and culturally and for the UFO people, and of course it's been codified in those couple of movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Nick, my battery's about to run out on my recorder, so
okay.
And we kept going. It's like, oh yeah, because all this stuff is great. And I always love talking to Nick, especially publicly, where we can kind of expound on what we think. But like I said, order the Men in Black book because you'll learn stuff. People listening to this show who are pretty damn well-versed in this stuff will learn quite a bit. So that's my plug for Nick's book. And thanks again, Nick.
Thanks, Greg. I had a good time, and thanks for having me on the show again. And I'll catch up with you anyway just for a chat or whatever.
Okay, yeah. We haven't done that in a while, and let's see where we're at. And plus, you can kick my butt like you always do, which is always a... It's like having psychic caffeine when I talk to Nick. All right, Nick, thanks
so
much.
All right, have a good night, Greg, and then say hello to Greg for me.
I will. You say hello to Dana, and I'll talk to you soon.
I will. All right, see you later, Greg. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, Nick Redfern, once again on the show, talking about Men in Black. Every time Nick's on, I almost feel like I have to, like, run and keep up with him. And that's why he remains a friend, because the best type of person to know is the kind of person that really keeps you on your toes. Nick does that, and I really appreciate it. So we'll be back next week, and I don't know who with. I didn't sign anybody up for next week yet. So who knows who's going to be on.
The next voice will be that of Mr. Albert K. Bender.
Welcome to all the delegates to the 7th Annual Congress of Scientific Ufologists, and to all those officials who have once again made it all possible. It is with great pride that I address this wonderful group, and my only regret is that I could not personally attend. But through the kind permission of the real pioneers in ufology, Mr. Gray Barker and Jim Moseley, I have been granted the privilege of speaking to this gathering. Many here have without any doubt read the book Flying Saucers and the Three Men, and therefore what I am about to relate will not be new. However, I would like to rehash the incidents that led up to more recent happenings. I have completed a manuscript for a second book telling of these new incidents in great detail. But so as not to make this a long discourse, I will not enlarge on each one. I will leave that to the book which Mr. Barker is reviewing at the present time. After my message, I would like all to personally speak to Mr. Barker if you want to read more about what has taken place. I also want to state here and now that many have the opinion that small fortunes have been made from flying saucers and the three men. But may I tell you now that this is not true, and I have personally donated mine to charity. The subject of my discourse this evening will be the world of Kaik. I'm not sure how many in the audience have read my book, but for those that haven't, I will first give you a short resume of what happened to me so that I may get to the main subject matter of tonight's message. In the year 1952, I organized a group called the International Flying Saucer Bureau one of the first organizations to study UFO and try to diagnose the many stories that were appearing in the daily newspapers about sightings. The group expanded until we had branches all around the world. We published a quarterly called Space Review, which contained news of interest to all members about UFOs in general. During the month of July 1952, I was plagued by many strange incidents involving such things as mysterious phone calls, which seemed to convey messages to me telepathically to discontinue my study of the UFO problem. I was annoyed by a strange person with glowing eyes at a local cinema to me telepathically to discontinue my study of the UFO problem. I was annoyed by a strange person with glowing eyes at a local cinema, and bluish lights and the smell of sulfur seemed to dominate my room at times. As I walked along the city streets at night, I had the feeling that I was being lifted off the ground and bluish lights would appear above my head. I was tormented by excruciating headaches almost every other day. An uncanny atmosphere enveloped me, and I had the sensation that someone or something was trying to gain control of my very body. In March of 1953, the IFSB conducted an experiment in mental telepathy. It was to be a mass participation by all members throughout the world. Mimeographed copies of the experiment were sent out to all members, showing the exact time and the message they must convey. At the exact moment, I myself joined in the endeavor and proceeded to send out the communications to any space beings that might be able to receive it. Little did I know at the time that I would be the one contacted. During my younger years, I had delved into the occult and the supernatural, and also learned from my parents that some of my ancestors were punished for the study and practice of witchcraft. I wondered at that time if some of this power might have rubbed off on me, and that I might too possess a hidden force. My answers to all this were forthcoming this very night, when I suddenly felt a strange chill over my whole body and could feel myself floating in the air above my bed. A strange message was conveyed to me, which was telepathic in its entirety. It went like this: "We have been watching you and your activities. Please be advised to discontinue delving into the mysteries of the universe. We will make an appearance if you disobey. We have a special assignment and must not be disturbed by your people. We are among you and know your every move. So please be advised, we are here on your earth." With this, the voice faded away, but I could sense something was watching me. My body seemed to drop suddenly, and I once again regained my senses and realized I was on my bed. The room was filled with yellow mist, and not far from my bed was a shadow, resembling that of a man, but as I made a move to rise from the bed, it vanished. The yellow mist was gradually fading, and my room was returning to normal. The smell of sulfur lingered in my room for almost 2 days. In July of the same year, when I returned from a summer vacation, I was visited by three men in black. We have heard so much about the three men in black since this first instance. They seemed to float off the floor, but wore clothes similar to an Earth clergyman. They frightened me half to death, since I did not know they were present until I got a strange prickly sensation on the back of my neck, as if I could feel someone staring at me. When I turned about, there they were, looking at me from the center of the room with their strange glowing eyes. Their eyes seemed to penetrate my very soul, and I experienced a burning sensation, extreme pain above my right eye. They did not speak, but I could understand the message they were conveying to me. It definitely was telepathic, and here is the message. You have dedicated yourself to the solution of the strange problem of unidentified objects in your atmosphere. Your interest is deep and sincere, and you have devoted many hours to it. We also know that such interest and determination might lead to something that could bring you harm. We feel that you are a very good contact for us on your planet Earth. You are an average person, and we know that what we tell you and show you will not be believed by anyone you might tell. You are not a person of great renown on your planet, therefore we have nothing to fear at present. We have a purpose for being here, and we will be here for some time yet. We must not be disturbed in our ultimate goal.